starting today with a subcommittee, our climate change subcommittee that I chair along with co-chair along with Commissioner Rothman. And I understand there's still a lot of people working their way to the room trying to enter our building. So we're going to just forego with the introductions until we get to the EQB agenda, since there's a lot to cover today. But before we begin, I wanted to turn it over to Commissioner Rothman as co-chair to make a few opening remarks.
Most importantly, we want to welcome everybody. Obviously, we've got a very good turnout. There's people upstairs waiting, and it's a very important topic. when people say 111D, you go, well, it's kind of crazy, but it's a broader topic than that. The Climate Change Subcommittee has a broad mandate. We also have been waiting for a while for to hear from the EPA about the rules on existing power plants. A few things. This is the beginning of the process for us to engage with the public, to get input now that we have received the proposed rules. And I just want to emphasize that from our perspective, it's important to get the perspectives of all of you that want to give us input. You know, going back, this isn't the start of a process in Minnesota. Minnesota has had a long history of public engagement around these issues, where all stakeholders have participated, brought their comments to the dialogue, and it's important for us to hear all of those comments from every stakeholder that we have. And with that, we are able to bring in and create what we think and hope to engage with and come up with what is the best for Minnesota. We've been given flexibility. We've been given parameters, and as you'll hear some of that today. So that's sort of just sort of the introductory piece of it from my perspective and from the committee's perspective on what we hope to achieve. So.
Thank you. Mr. Fredrickson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to acknowledge Senator Klobuchar's staff presence here today, Greg Swanholm, who is the, I think at this point, the longest-serving member of Senator Klobuchar's staff, and I'm really appreciative of the fact that Greg is here to talk about or listen to the discussion regarding 111. So thanks, Greg.
Thank you. Just a little bit about the logistics of this meeting so that everyone knows what to expect. We've got a presentation from staff from the Pollution Control Agency. Dr. Mark Seeley will be here to present some information. We also will be hearing from some of our friends in utility industry and their perspectives. We also are going to, and the non-government organizations, then we're going to have a listening session for public comments. And if you are interested in being heard before the board as a part of that listening session, we'd ask you to fill out one of these slips of paper. They are found over there at the doorway. Bring them up to the board secretary, and we'll make sure that we get you a time slot to be heard today. Because of time, because of the volume of input that we may be getting, we might have to limit people's time in their comments. So if I could just encourage everyone to think about a 3 to 5 minute period of time to speak before the board, that would be really helpful. If you go much longer than that, you might get reined in by the chair to try to keep us, give everyone the opportunity to be heard. Our goal today is to unpack a little bit of this story around what the 111D rule is. 111D is a section of the Clean Air Act. It was promulgated in the 70s by Congress. It has to do with all kinds of air emissions. And the primary responsibility of our agency, the Pollution Control Agency, is to issue permits that fulfill the requirements of that act. Something that happened was, you may remember the legal debate that was ongoing over whether carbon emissions were considered indeed a pollutant under the terms of the Clean Air Act. That was settled by the Supreme Court sometime in about 2007, thereabouts. And since then, the EPA has been under a duty to develop rules for various sectors of emissions that put carbon into the atmosphere. Their first effort was around vehicle emission standards. And now this is the largest sector, is the power sector emission standards. So they have taken this one on, spurred by President Obama's climate action plan. But certainly the EPA is under a duty from the court decision to promulgate rules that address carbon as a pollutant. And so that's what we're going to hear from. First is the staff from our agency, David Thornton, Assistant Commissioner, and Frank Kolesch will be presenting a brief background on what the 111D proposal is that EPA has put forward. Mr. Thornton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For those of you who are here to get complete clarity on this rule, you can get up and leave now. It's 686 pages long, and there's several hundred other pages of supporting material. And while we've gone through it, we certainly don't understand it all. But we understand some parts of it, at least we think. And I'm going to try to give you as good an overview of what we see so far and some of the concerns that we see. And then we'll see how far we get. EPA calls this their clean power rule, and it's a part of President Obama's climate action plan that he announced in June of 2013. One component of that you've already heard presentations on, and that's climate adaptation and climate resilience. The other component of it was to promulgate rules for power plants. As Mr. Stein said, these 111 sections are part of the Clean Air Act. There's a 111B, which applies to new power plants, and 111D, which is what we're going to be talking about today, which is regulations for existing fossil fuel power plants. The 111D proposal is out on final review by EPA. We have not paid much attention to that because we're not expecting any new coal-fired power plants in Minnesota. We haven't worried about it. And so this will be about 111D. Sometimes they're also called new source performance standards, and this all will apply for plants that were built after the proposal, which is January 8 of 2014. It applies to existing fossil fuel-fired power plants, and we think that that means just about every facility in the state that you would think of as a power plant, so even some of the small ones. We also believe that it will apply to some, and we're not completely sure about this, it will apply to some industrial power facilities associated with manufacturing plants, and for example, the North Shore power plant associated with the North Shore mine. That's an area that we're still seeking further clarity on. It establishes new emission guidelines, and it is the state that is ultimately responsible for developing a plan to meet these guidelines. And further, it's the Pollution Control Agency that has the delegation from EPA with the authority under the Clean Air Act to make this an enforceable regulation. EPA has been describing this based on the overall goal that they think it will achieve, and this is a fairly important feature of their proposal. They have been saying that this will reduce utility sector carbon dioxide emissions by 30% by 2030 from a 2005 baseline. All of those numbers are important. 2005 is important because that's a benchmark year that many countries in Europe and some states in the U.S., including us, are using as a baseline for measuring progress for greenhouse gas reductions. The 30% is important because they want to establish a significant reduction from this sector to demonstrate the United States' commitment to addressing greenhouse gas emission reductions and climate change. This is just a proposal. We expect things in this proposal to change before it becomes final. I think that whatever changes, these kinds of things will not. I think EPA is still going to want to try to achieve a 30% reduction nationally as a result of this proposal. The Clean Air Act identifies the method of reducing emissions under 111B as the best system of emission reductions. And in this case, EPA has looked outside the fence line of power plants to define what the best system of emission reductions is. And this is, in fact, something that we encourage them to do, as well as many other states and commenters. They're looking at what can be done within the fence line of the facility. They're also looking at renewable energy. They're looking at energy efficiency and other measures that can help reduce emissions from the utility sector. And in fact, in taking a look at what a best system of emission reductions might be, EPA singled out a number of times in their proposal Minnesota for being a state that has already a best system of emission reductions in place. And that's due to the efforts of our power plants and utilities and the legislature in passing various laws like the Next Generation Energy Act. The other feature of this that we also asked for is that allows great flexibility in how you can comply with this. And we think that's important because the more flexibility in how you can comply, the least cost the regulation will be. EPA has estimated what the benefits and costs of this proposal will be. And their national estimates are that public health and climate benefits would be somewhere between $55 billion and $93 billion per year in 2030. And that's compared to what they're calculating as costs of $7.3 billion to $8.8 billion a year. Some of the things that go into these estimates are the same kind of cost-benefit estimates that they use for all of their air quality regulatory promulgations. It's looking primarily at the health impacts of particulate matter and ozone, which would be reduced also as a result of this proposal as a co-benefit to the carbon dioxide reductions. And they're also factoring into that the federal social cost of carbon that EPA has been using to measure regulations. While I expect that at some point they'll come out with some state-specific cost-benefit analyses, they have not yet done that. Now, I mentioned that this was going to be nationally a 30% reduction from 2005 levels, but that's not how they determined what the reduction obligations are going to be. They calculated reduction obligations for each individual state based on data from those states and specific circumstances within those states. And the baseline year that they used for doing this was 2012 because it was the year for which they had the latest data set to use to make these calculations. They've calculated a statewide utility emission rate target, two targets, one for 2020 and another for 2030. They're expressed in terms of pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. And the proposed rates are not going to mean anything to you, and frankly, they didn't mean much to us either when we first saw them. But the 2020 rate is 911 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour, and the 2030 rate is 873. Our starting point is somewhere around 1,400, and some people have calculated that that would be about a 16 million ton reduction in annual carbon dioxide emissions. We're still going through these calculations, and we're not going to agree with anybody's numbers until we've been able to reproduce what EPA's done and verify those calculations ourselves. But to get to each state's individual target, EPA developed what I think is a fairly elegant and yet quite complicated equation for calculating each state's target. I should indicate that the way they calculated this target has no bearing on how a state might choose to meet the target. It's just the calculation that results in what your target is. I think that they did listen to a lot of stakeholders, and they've taken a lot of things into account, and they've tried to balance a lot of interests and concerns nationally. So some states are going to feel like their interests were not as well addressed in this formula as others. And I think that's only to be expected in a proposal that's as complicated as this. We'll go through that, and then I'll share some of the concerns that we have about it. They set this formula up by looking at four different boxes for calculations. They have a box for the coal units, a box for the natural gas units, a box for basically zero carbon resources, which is mostly about renewables, but also includes something about nuclear power. And then they have a box for energy efficiency or demand side management. And when you look at this together, that's what they're calling their best system of emission reductions. How this stuff is calculated is very complicated. I'm going to go through it at a very high level. And then if you want to go a little bit deeper, Frank is here to help me answer questions. But let's dive at least a little bit into the algebra of this equation that they created. For the coal unit box, they took 2012 efficiency rates at the power plant, at the coal-fired power plants, and how much those units were being utilized in 2012, and calculated a number. And then they just assumed that generally the utility industry can achieve a 6% improvement in efficiency in operating those plants. And this is, you know, changing out generators, plumbing, and pipes, the kind of stuff that Xcel has done at the King plant, the kind of stuff that Minnesota Power has done at Boswell 3 and 4. So that's not available to us now at those units. But this is the assumption that they made. And so that calculates your coal box target. For the gas units and for the gas box, they just decided that a gas unit can run 70% of the time. In Minnesota, I think our 2012 usage capacity for gas was at about 24%. So that would be ramping it up quite a bit. But that's the assumption that they used for calculating the gas box piece of this equation. For the zero emission or zero carbon resources under renewable energy, they took a regional data for renewable energy standards, and I don't even know honestly which region we're in, but it's the states around us, and they took an average and they applied that to all the states in that region. So for us, that happened to be 15%. We have a higher renewable energy standard than that. Some of the states around us have considerably lower ones. But in any case, EPA assigned this to us, and that's the reduction that we're expected to meet by 2020 through 2030. So in this case, our target is way lower than what we're actually generating by renewable energy right now. So this one favors Minnesota considerably. The nuclear portion of it is rather, we've got the word opaque up there. I think we've figured it out a little bit more, and it's not so as much opaque as it is odd. The Energy Information Agency apparently believes that about 6% of the nation's nuclear capacity is going to be retired by 2030. And so EPA discounted, without going to where those units are that are going to be retired, EPA discounted every state that has nuclear power, their nuclear power generation by 6% as an incentive to keep that power running. And I don't know whether this idea would be an incentive in any case, but smearing it out over everybody that's got nuclear generation doesn't seem like maybe the best choice. But we'll be getting more clarity on this. And then as far as demand-side management box, the goal is to get to 1.5% per year improvement in energy efficiency. In 2012, we were at 1.12% according to EPA's data. I don't know if Commerce's data is a little different than that, but just for arguments, let's say that's about where we are, and that we would have to ramp up by about 0.2% per year to reach 1.5% by 2020. So we're reasonably good shape on this one. I mentioned that states have wide latitude and flexibility in determining how to meet the goals. You do not have to run your gas units at 70% capacity, like they calculated that box. But you can do whatever you want. We can, and this would be the more the command and control method and possibly the least cost-efficient method, we could take that limit that I showed you in an earlier slide and apply that to every single power plant individually and make them all meet it. And that would get us there, but it wouldn't be very smart. We can also do something that people are referring to as a utility portfolio approach, which is where we would give Xcel Energy operating in Minnesota that number, and they would have to make sure that all of their units met that number as best they could by making decisions and trading between their units and that sort of thing. We can go with an emission rate, which is the way that EPA is proposing this number, this target, or we can convert it into a mass, a tons of carbon dioxide, which is something that more of us are a little bit easier to grasp in our brains. And we're certain we're doing those calculations right now because we want to see how all that works. The other thing that EPA is actually encouraging, if it makes sense, is for states to consider multi-state compliance. And some of the theories behind this are that a lot of utilities operate in more than one state. And to broaden the footprint that utilities and states have to try to comply with these, this proposal would perhaps make it even more cost efficient. But we have another unique situation here. You're going to hear a little bit about it in a minute from Great River Energy. Most of their customers are in Minnesota. Most of their generation is in North Dakota. What does a rule like this do when you have an iron wall between the two? In terms of complying with this, we have to submit our plan by July 1 of 2016. It's possible to get a one-year extension if you submit certain commitments at that point in time, and it's also possible to get a two-year extension if you're going to be submitting a multi-state plan. This timing is important because we're likely to need to promulgate new rules to make this work, and as you know, rulemaking in Minnesota is not all that swift, and we're going to need as much time as we can to do it. The other thing that's important to know is that these reductions that we're going to be submitting in our plan have to be permanent, they have to be verifiable, and they have to be enforceable. So if, for example, we're counting on nuclear power through 2030 in order to meet this emission rate, and yet we know that those units are going to be retired at some point after that, our plan needs to address how that power is going to be supplied in the absence of the presence of those nuclear units. So that's going to be a trick. We're going to need to work with Commissioner Rothman and his staff very closely as we work through this. And we're also going to need to work very closely with the Public Utilities Commission. Okay, that was a quick overview. I'll tell you a few things about what we are thinking at this point. And you're probably going to hear more about this today. I think overall EPA gave us about as very much of what we asked for in this proposal. They considered renewables. They considered energy efficiency. They considered flexibility and how you comply with it. And they did, to a lesser degree, consider credit for early action. The area where they gave them some credit was in renewables. I think that they fell short in credit for things like upgrading plants with efficiency and retiring plants and replacing them with natural gas. So that's an issue that we're going to be looking at. If you look at the national picture, our target looks more aggressive than 30%, and it's more aggressive than our neighboring states. And so we're going to be looking into whether that's fair and whether there's some things that need to be addressed there. Some states didn't get much of a target, and that's going to be an issue that we're going to look at as well. We've already been talking to a few of the states like us that took early action, and they're feeling the same thing, that their targets are higher than they expected, and they feel like they didn't get quite the I don't want to use the word credit, but EPA's proposal and their formula didn't really recognize early action as they had hoped. In 2012, Sherco 3 wasn't running, and that makes a difference in how this is all calculated, and it affects our bottom line and makes our target greater than if they had put Sherco 3 in, and that's because the turbine at Sherco 3 was down for rebuilding. I think that was an unintended consequence, and I'm not expecting that to be much of an issue. And if we find other errors like that in this work that EPA did, I'm sure that they're going to be more than willing to hear about that. We do believe that the renewable energy portion of this does allow credit for renewable energy that's not in our state but that serves our state, but there's some clarification around that that we need. And hydropower is kind of a mystery. It looks like they didn't count existing hydropower, but it's not clear to us whether how new hydropower fits into this, and that will be important. They've also made a discount for energy efficiency for power that you import, that's net imported power. And I think that the intention there was they didn't want to double count credits for energy efficiency. And we're still trying to sort out why that works the way they think it did and how that impacts things. So even with the progress that our utilities have made, you should remember that we're not on target to meet our Next Generation Energy Act reduction goals. So we're going to need to keep that in mind as we sort through this. So our next steps are to continue to deconstruct what EPA did and make sure that we fully understand it. PCA and Commerce are working together to develop a set of questions that we still have on this rule, even though there have been multiple conference calls and webinars and there's dozens more scheduled. EPA is planning to set up conference calls with each state to go through their questions and answer them as best they can so that we can fully understand what we've got here. And then we want to regroup our power sector stakeholder group and get input from outsiders, understand what their thinking is. We want to make sure that our technical people are on the same page with the utilities technical people and that we are all working with the same set of numbers. And then we'll begin sorting out what our comments are going to be. And if, you know, at the end of the day, if we feel that Minnesota didn't get a fair shake in this proposal, we'll certainly be commenting to that effect. And if we think that other states got too fair of a shake in this, we're going to be commenting to that effect as well. That was a quick overview. I'd be happy to try to answer, or Frank would be happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thornton. Just quickly, for the sake of everyone in the room, is there a date by which we expect EPA will publish the rule?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I meant to say that it was published today.
Oh.
So the comment period starts today and ends in 120 days. And
so they knew we were meeting.
Yeah, I guess.
And felt it was important to align themselves with this
Minnesota
date.
So mid-October is when the comments will be due.
Thank you. Board members, do you have questions about the presentation or about the what was just explained? Great.
Mr.
Saxhog.
What is Sherco 3?
Sherco 3 is one of three units in Sherburne County that Xcel Energy runs. It's their three largest coal-fired units, and actually Sherco 3 is the largest of the three. It's also the newest of the three.
Okay.
The reason it was down was an accident and a replacement.
Turbine failure.
Thank you. Excuse me. Mr. Knapstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, could you elaborate what rulemaking do you calculate that Minnesota is going to have to go through in order to complete their plan?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We anticipate
that we will have to have rulemaking to establish all of the monitoring and reporting and verification requirements that are going to be required by EPA for a state plan. At a minimum, we're going to have to do that because that's clearly stated by EPA that they expect that all of the requirements in a state plan be enforceable under the Clean Air Act. And that means we're going to have to establish what kind of reporting mechanism Minnesota utilities will need and the affected units will need. And we'll have to be looking very closely and working with the Department of Commerce to determine what kinds of additional reporting requirements beyond what's already required for the renewable energy standard or the electric efficiency standard in order to meet EPA's requirements for enforceability. There may be also other rulemaking authorities necessary to give the Pollution Control Agency the authority to set certain kinds of conditions into permits for the affected units to try to achieve some of the concepts that EPA has laid out for achieving these reductions as far as looking at how does a pollution control agency impact the utilization rate of a natural gas combined cycle plant when there's also a market system out there that operates that. We would have to figure out how that would work and what EPA expects of that and what kinds of authorities and guidelines or rules would we require to have that authority to put those kinds of conditions into an air quality permit, because with this rule, it makes all of these programs that a state like Minnesota has with renewable energy standards, electric efficiency standards, we have to bring those into the enforceability under the Clean Air Act, not just the enforceability under the state statutes. And that's where we were going to have to look at what kinds of reporting, monitoring, and other authorities we will need to bring those requirements to the affected utilities.
I'll just add that the more creative we get in how we choose to comply with this, the more likely we might need to go and get legislative authority. For example, if we decide we want to work with one or more other states and submit joint compliance plans, that would almost certainly require legislative action.
Any other questions? All right, I do have to report that we are beyond our fire code limits for this room. So what I am going to do, because of the meeting is being recorded, and so what I would like to do is ask agency staff, those of you from governmental entities that can observe this meeting separately, to please leave the room so that our guests from the public have places to sit. If you're making a presentation, obviously this does not apply to you. If this is central to your business, we expect you to stay. But if we could accommodate some of our overflow by reducing the number of state agency staff in the room, I'd appreciate that.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Thornton and your staff for the great work in putting that together and simplifying a complex rule.
Thanks. I also appreciated, for my sake, the hearkening back to my seventh grade algebra class when I said some of these are negative numbers and some of these are positive numbers, and each one of the boxes has to be added in that light. So it was good reminder from Commissioner Thornton that we still need to remember how we learned our algebra. We have Dr. Mark Seeley with us, and welcome to the subcommittee, Doctor, and we appreciate your time today to give us an update on what's current in our climate change patterns in Minnesota.
If I might say, I heard your presentation last week, and the updated information you have there is always astounding, and I can never say enough how much I love hearing your perspective. So welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you. Out of respect to Commissioner Landwehr, I would like to correct on the agenda for today that I am not your state climatologist. I'm your extension climatologist, your wonderful state climatologist who I work with on a daily basis is Greg Spoden of the DNR. My task, I think, briefly is to describe, as Commissioner Stein alluded to, what's been going on. I'll focus my remarks both in a quantitative sense but also in a character sense of what's going on as we interpret our state climate database. I have no remarks about what models tell us we are going to evolve to in the future, because my premise here today is simply stated that climate change is already going on with great statistical significance in our measurements, and it is already having significant consequences in our state. And so I simply want to concentrate my remarks on that. One of the background themes for all of us to comprehend is that climate change is going on all over the world in many respects, but with disparity. Now, we here in the Minnesota landscape, as evidenced on the map of temperature change that's occurred over the last 100-plus years, color-coded in this depiction by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration scientists, clearly shows, based on the red and pink coloration on the U.S. map, that we in the Western Great Lakes region, including our Minnesota landscape, occupy an area of the USA geography where the temperature change is most amplified. That shows up in our state database, and as many of you have heard me talk about this, I can cite example after example in our state database where our temperatures have changed quite significantly over our lifetime. And I might further add, at an accelerated rate in recent decades. The other signature attribute that we see disparity in is the change in precipitation. And again, taking a snapshot of our country and looking again at what's happened relative to the change in precipitation, we again in the Western Great Lakes and High Plains area of the U.S. landscape occupy an area of geography where the change in precipitation is most amplified. And my goodness, look at all the examples we're seeing this month. The Rock River Basin in southwestern Minnesota, for example, and northwestern Iowa is at a flood stage this week that is equivalent to the upper Mississippi at flood stage, an all-time flood crest. So we see, again, disparity, but we see disparity in the context that what the geography we occupy is an area of greatly amplified change. Now, that change is not a nice smooth curve across time. We live in one of the most variable climates in the entire world, certainly one of the most variable in the Northern Hemisphere. I would remind all the commissioners, we hold the North American record for the coldest Groundhog's Day ever measured, minus 60, February 2nd, 1996, and the highest North American heat index ever measured, July 19th, 2011, at Moorhead, Minnesota, 134 degrees. You can look to your heart's desire and not find another piece of landscape in the Northern Hemisphere that's likely to exhibit those extremes. There's variation. There's huge variation in our climate record, and it continues to this day unabated. Here's a depiction of the winter we just went through. You can see by the color coding here that the pinks and reds highlight areas that had a relatively warm winter of 2013-2014, and you can see areas in the blues where it was cold. Where did the cold air concentrate in the Northern Hemisphere this last winter? It concentrated over us. Okay, it's done this in the past. It's going to do this again in the future. And so the level of aberration we experienced was that we reported the nation's coldest temperature 64 times this last winter. There is a depiction of us relative to the rest of the USA in terms of the cold temperature depiction. So we've only had in about the last 150 years of climate records in Minnesota, we've only had five or six winters of this order of magnitude. Simply stated, what goes around comes around, and even in the modern record, even in the context of increasing temperature change in our state of Minnesota, we are still subject to this type of aberration. But if we look at the big picture, we look at the broadest field of view we can look at, we see that our temperatures are changing. Even in the context of our winter minimum temperatures, which this graphic depicts, It's pooled data from all observations in the state, and it's a depiction of the average winter minimum temperature, December through February, calculated from all observations. You'll see on the far right-hand side, we've included the most recent winter. That's where you see the great negative deviation there. But even when we account for that, it dropped the long-term trend line only marginally from what it once was. The long-term trend line is steeply upward in this record, as it is in most locations. But temperature isn't the only attribute that is changing in our Minnesota climate that we need to be concerned about. Temperature is changing. There's seasonal disparity, and in fact, there's even disparity between the minimum and maximum readings. But it is nevertheless changing, and in scientific terms, it is changing with statistical significance. The realm of change that is occurring is beyond any pace of change we have detected in the instrumental record. That's an important perspective to share. Dew point, water vapor is changing just as we feel it today. We are having more tropical air masses visit Minnesota. We are consequently having more issuances of heat advisories by the National Weather Service, not because our thermometer is rising to 110 or 112 degrees as it once did in our history, but because the combination of temperature and dew point is making the air feel that way and have the same physiological effect on us. And it looks like we've got some more of that coming up this summer. I wouldn't be surprised if we're on the threshold of having a lot more heat advisories issued this summer by the National Weather Service. Lastly, the third attribute, as we know, is the amplified variation and extremes of precipitation. And speaking of extremes, it's important to note that we do have, as we dissect the state climate record, we have clear statistical evidence of changes in the central measures of our climate attributes, the means, the modes, the medians, but we also have clear statistical evidence of the change in the frequency of extremes. And of course, that's where all the consequences lie. Most of the consequences on our infrastructure and our natural resources lie in the realm of the extremes that we're subjected to. And speaking of extremes, many of you have had the opportunity, as I have, to hear the researchers from the Severe Storms Prediction Center in Oklahoma come to Minnesota and talk about the changing characteristics of our severe weather. Current research shows, and it's depicted on this map, color-coded in the central North American continent with the reds and the pinks, that by all measures of the upper atmosphere, the elements, and in severe weather meteorology, we call these the ingredients methods, the elements of the upper atmosphere that contribute to the formation of severe convective weather are increasing frequency over us. Not distinctly and in isolation over Minnesota, it's simply more fairly stated that they're becoming more frequent at higher latitude positions. So Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota, Manitoba, Ontario are seeing more ingredients for severe weather more frequently than any time in their history. In fact, arguably at a frequency that was once observed in states like Oklahoma and Kansas. And so as that plays out, we are definitely getting more severe weather elements, as we've already seen earlier this summer. In fact, I would remind you, our observer at Waseca has reported 3 2-inch thunderstorm rains in less than a week. Recurrence climatology for the 2-inch thunderstorm rain is you're supposed to get about 2 of those per year, not 3 in 1 week. Impacts. The impacts are probably motivationally why you as EQB members and we as Minnesota citizens should be enthusiastic and working as a community towards the implementation of these EPA rules because of this motivation. Climate change is real. It's already having impacts on our state infrastructure, already measurable in a variety of sectors of our infrastructure, our water resources, our public health, our energy use, any number of other attributes that we rely on for our quality of life. Secondly, it's having impacts on our natural resources. And the preservation, the continuity in those natural resources is being threatened by the higher incidence of extremes that we are experiencing. So bottom line here for all of us in the room to absorb is simply this. The statistical evidence for climate change is here and now. It's already present. It's already been analyzed by myself and several others. It is in our face. It's right before us. Further, by all other realms of research going on within our Minnesota community, we see that the level of change already being measured is already having significant consequence. And how much we can adapt and adjust for this significant consequence is probably going to be tested severely. And the only way to get through this, in many, many people's opinions, is an implementation of public policy that helps mitigate this for our future. So that's my message to you today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Dr. Seeley. Board members, any questions today?
John, I have one.
Mr. Landry.
Dr. Seeley, I guess trying to figure out what the future looks like in terms of, you know, based on these projections, drier, wetter, do the models project a consistent pattern? Because upon a time, I'd heard that the Dakotas would get drier, but I think one of the maps up there showed the Dakotas both getting wetter.
Yeah, the general tendency, there is some disparity in the models. First, let me correct that I'm not a modeler, but I do read the literature. And there's some, the trend we're on is clearly wetter, but also amplified variability. And we see that play out consequentially, and Commissioner Landwehr, I know you're well aware of this. Since the new millennium, we've had more flash floods prevail than we've seen in the past, but we have also seen areas of the Minnesota landscape left out and therefore in extreme to severe drought most every year. It's been the exceptional year that we have not seen drought visit the state of Minnesota, yet at the same moment in time, we've been seeing flash floods visit. So I think we have to be careful here in trying to make or discern what the future holds relative to one characteristic of that precipitation attribute. Because it's a higher amplified variability in our precipitation signature on the landscape, I think we're going to continue to see areas of the state more frequently in drought, not necessarily the same area, but some area of the state, and conversely, more areas of the state exposed to intense levels of precipitation that cause flash floods. I might further add, Environment Canada is in agreement on this trend, and even over in Europe and Asia, at the latitude positions that are analogous to ours, those meteorological services are also in agreement with this trend. So there's something going on latitude-wise in the Northern Hemisphere that's involving us with regard to amplified precipitation and also involving others that are in similar landscape positions to ours.
Doctor, you're just to follow up on this, you've talked about the variability and the statistical analysis, and as I heard you before a couple weeks ago, can you give examples of that those extremes just to put a the picture? I mean, we've witnessed flooding and tornadic weather, but just the extremes. You talked a little bit about temperature.
One example, Commissioner Rothman, that you probably heard me use that still serves as a very good example is the St. Louis River in Carlton County. We have well over a 100-year record of volumetric flow on the St. Louis River in Carlton County, Minnesota. And here in June of 2012, when we had the flash flood in Duluth and Cloquet and Two Harbors with the 10-inch rainfall amounts, we sent a discharge crest down the St. Louis River that surpassed anything measured in its 100-plus-year record, 45,000 cubic feet per second, analogous to the Mississippi at flood flow. And then we went right back into drought. In fact, that area later that year was declared by USDA as a federal drought disaster because basically the spigot turned off and they hardly got any more rain. And the volumetric flow on the St. Louis River by November of the same year was down to 458 cubic feet per second. So on a 106-year volumetric flow record for one of our Minnesota watersheds, We have two points of extreme that are 5 months apart. If that's not exemplary of what amplified precipitation variability can do to you, I don't know what is. But this plays out in a variety of other things. We're probably going to have the same thing happen on the Rock River Basin this year. I wouldn't be surprised. We may have the same thing happen on the Rainy this year, because the Rainy also reached a record flood crest this month at Manitou up by International Falls. And yet again, with this amplified variation, if they too go into drought, were to go into drought, for example, in 2014, we might all of us, well, of course, that's more regulated flow, but we might also see wide variation on these watersheds.
Thank you.
Dr. Ellinger,
you're smiling. Dr. Seeley, since you're an icon in Minnesota like Garrison Keillor, paraphrasing Garrison, is it true that is Minnesota, where the weather is more extreme, where the climate is most variable, and all the means, medians, and modes are now above average?
Yes, I would say, yes, yes, all are above average. Yes, yes. Yes, I think an important feature for me to express as a citizen to you is simply this. My heritage in Minnesota goes back to my great-great-grandfather, who founded Mazeppa in Wabasha County in 1854, and served in the territorial and state legislatures. I've read his papers. This issue we're coping with is equivalent, in my view, as important to the basic issues that were coped with by that first Minnesota state legislature. And I think the more citizens we can get involved in this issue, the better off we're going to be down the road. And to believe in the importance of this issue, I encourage all our citizens to simply look at what our data are telling us. Period.
Commissioner Stein.
Commissioner Clark-Steven, thanks.
Can you speak to what your statistical data shows you as far as how quickly this is progressing?
The rate of change on a decade, if we stepwise the statistics of this on a decade-by-decade basis, the pace of change that's going on in the High Plains states, the Dakotas, and Minnesota, is a faster pace of change geographically than many are seeing in other states. It is not quite the equivalent of the pace of change of polar Canada. Polar Canada, quite frankly, is even faster. It's about two or three times the pace of change that we might have expected based on the historical variation from decade to decade. I don't know how much more it's going to increase in pace, and this is a worrisome piece of the puzzle. We visit about this all the time at American Meteorological Society meetings and AGU meetings and others at the national level, because there's uncertainty in whether this pace of change is going to continue to quicken and what's its ultimate magnitude going to be.
Commissioner.
On this and following up, when we're talking about norms, you'd commented before, when I heard you before, about how what we consider a norm today over the last decade or two is different than it was before because of changes in requirements and what you report as norms. Can you comment upon that?
Well, we have changed the not the bare data, but we've changed the methods we've used over time to try to compensate for some of the background changes. If, for example, an observer that we call Sauk Rapids has changed locations, we try to make adjustments for that. We try to make statistical adjustments for the location change. And unfortunately, in our state database, that's played out in a variety of circumstances. So we have statistical manipulation of the database that tries to account for that. Now the way we analyze data is we use grid analysis. We don't use point-specific data so much as when we analyze what the normals, what we call normals or averages for the state are, we overlay the state with a grid system, and then we try to calculate the statistics associated with the grid system over the state. We still have 252 observers in the state of Minnesota that give us the daily readings for that. And some of those histories go back to the 1880s, and and you've probably heard me talk about that too. But we've changed the methods, but believe me, dozens upon dozens of statisticians have worked on this across time, and we feel like now we're more fairly representing both the temporal and the spatial variation across the state in those statistics. We no longer have the real bullseye outliers because of some, you know, something that happened in terms of sighting or something that happened in terms of errors in the instrumentation or any number of other things.
Okay. Ms. Rommel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Healy, a couple of years ago I was at a seminar with Dr. Hansen, and we were talking about the tipping point. I don't remember exactly, was it 4 degrees?
I'm sorry, I'm not an expert on tipping points. The modeling community uses that jargon more than the measurements community, so I'm not accustomed to using that. And I'm not prepared really to give you a very informed opinion about tipping points. If there is a tipping point out there, you would probably need to converse with a modeler and see what the latest consensus is on that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Board members, we're going to have to wrap up so we get through our next presentation. If we could just thank you, Dr. Seeley, for your presentation and your time before the board
thank
today.
Thank you very
appreciate
much.
Appreciate it. Also, just while the next group of presenters moves to the table, please, I'd like to just let folks know that we've got a little overflow problem in our parking lot, and some of you may have parked in places that were designated as reserved. We're holding off tow trucks, so we're trying to be the kinder, gentler pollution control agency.
It's a little out of character for you, isn't it?
It's actually quite in keeping with some parts of the agency. That we want to make sure that you, if you are in a spot that's reserved, or if you can move your vehicle close to 3:30, we'll keep the tow trucks away until 3:30, but after that, we'd ask you to please move your vehicles if they're not legally parked. With that, I'd like to welcome the next group to the board today, and again remind folks, if you're interested in speaking to the board to the subcommittee today about this topic, please complete one of these little purple forms. They're over on the table near the door. Bring it to the board secretary, and we'll make sure that you have the opportunity to be heard. With that, I'm going to leave it to the group to decide how you want to proceed, and please introduce yourself.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and board members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's an honor. I'll be speaking first. My name is Brad Crabtree. I'm vice president for fossil energy at the Great Plains Institute. And in this context, I direct at the staff level, a regional project called the Midwestern Power Sector Collaborative, which has been working for a little over 2 years trying to build consensus between states, the private sector, and environmental advocates on a path forward for implementing an EPA rule focused on existing sources, power plants, as we've been discussing today. I'll just begin. The Great Plains Institute, for those of you who don't know, based here in Minneapolis, working regionally. I actually work from North Dakota myself. We work broadly on energy policy and technology, from renewables to efficiency to fossil energy. And we work with all the key stakeholders that have input into public policy on energy. And that, of course, we've worked for years in Minnesota and work with many of you in the room. So a little over 2 years ago, actually it was in the fall of 2011, we brought together a group of stakeholders in the Midwest. We held a meeting in Detroit and explored the possibility of, is there an interest in a dialogue on how to best implement a whole range of EPA rules that were coming forward that affect coal-based generation. And what brought the group together is some common interests that the region as a whole has. First and foremost is a continued reliance on coal in the region's power sector. Obviously, Minnesota has made extraordinary commitments and achievements in renewable energy and energy efficiency. You heard in David Thornton's presentation that EPA has actually now recognized Minnesota nationally in this proposed rule in terms of what you've accomplished. However, by national standards, Minnesota remains a coal-reliant state compared to some other regions of the country. We also have a very well-developed regional power market and a regional transmission organization in MISO. We are the industrial and agricultural heartland of the United States and remain that. Also, we have a fairly pragmatic, non-confrontational, mostly approach to public policy and energy policy. And so those were some of the things that we felt were common ground that could help a group of stakeholders reach consensus. And so based on that first meeting, we began in early 2012. For those of you who know this time frame, that was long before EPA was undertaking serious work to develop this proposed existing source rule. And I'd like to point out that but for Minnesota, this project would not have happened, because even earlier than that, here in this room, in fact, Minnesota began bringing together your own stakeholders within the state and looking at that time there was the prospect of an existing source rule, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and other state agencies wanted input on how you could best find a path forward, assuming EPA were to implement such a regulation. And based on the positive response to that discussion at the time, that was the impetus for this regional effort. And there are two major rationales for the Midwestern Power Sector Collaborative. One, as I've already mentioned, that because of our dependence on coal, the Midwest and the Northern Plains are potentially significantly impacted economically by an EPA rule. And that if we could find consensus among coal-based power companies, environmental advocates, and state officials in this region, given the importance of the Midwest, that would be very persuasive nationally in terms of how the EPA approaches this rule. It was not easy at first. It actually took 2 years, to be precise, 23 months of the group meeting. There were times when some participants on one side or the other thought about backing out, but folks stuck together. And at the end, they became the first group with this broad range of interests to come together and make consensus recommendations to EPA on how EPA ought to implement this rule. And I think it's important, perhaps less in Minnesota, maybe in some of the more conservative states in the region, to emphasize that just because these parties were engaged does not mean that they were endorsing EPA's role. I think, as you all know, there's an ongoing debate about whether EPA should exercise authority in this area under the Clean Air Act. I suspect in Minnesota there's broadly a view that is a positive direction, but it's still very much debated across the region. So the group instead chose to focus on assuming the rule would move forward and be implemented, how best to do it. And that was the point of consensus in the path forward. And I'll just briefly, I won't read the list of who's involved in the project, except to point out the Minnesotans that are involved. David Thornton was an original participant in the group. Bill Grant has also been involved on behalf of the state of Minnesota. What's striking about this, the participation of these states, is we have red states, we have blue states, we have rural states, we have fossil fuel states, and across the map, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Michigan, Minnesota, of course, Illinois. So it's a very, now Missouri here recently. We also have regulated utilities. This project is unique in having generation and transmission cooperatives at the table, two of the five largest in the country, Great River Energy being one of them. On the investor-owned utility side, Xcel Energy has also been an original participant in this project. We also, however, have merchant generators represented and municipal power providers as well. And then we have environmental advocates. Mike Bull is the one who's Minnesota-based at this time. The participation has varied a little bit over the past 2.5 years, but we have an excellent representation of environmental advocates working regionally and at the state level. So very briefly, what did the group agree to? First of all, they agreed on a set of guiding principles that they felt ought to inform EPA's approach to the rule. And for the purposes of presenting something, I've tried to distill down. This is not the exact wording of how it appears in the regulations or the recommendations, but achieving meaningful emissions reductions while ensuring reliability and affordability, and making sure that whatever EPA does, we meet both those tests. Also providing certainty and consistent investment signals so that we can deploy technology predictably over time. The other thing that's quite striking is that we have industry, state, and NGO consensus on the need for flexibility. It's not very often that you have industry and environmental groups agreeing on flexibility. Regulatory flexibility is something that's very desirable, and I think that's very important. Early action was talked about. This group felt strongly that early action ought to be an important component of the EPA rule. That's obvious for industry that's and ratepayers who have made these investments in energy efficiency and renewables. But the environmental advocates in the group feel this way as well, because they've called on public policymakers like yourselves to make these policy commitments to clean energy, and they want to see that those clean energy investments and policies recognized in the EPA rule. And then finally, regional cooperation. Nobody in the group felt that states should be required to work together, but that EPA should make every reasonable possibility available for states to achieve regional compliance in a cost-effective, flexible way. I won't read this list either, but if you look on the screen, the group takes a very broad ecumenical view of what ought to count. As long as it can be responsibly verified and measured, the group feels it ought to count in terms of states and their regulated companies achieving these emissions reductions. And so you'll see many of the things on that list that Minnesota has already long committed to: energy efficiency, renewables, shifting to gas away from coal in different contexts, as well as plant-based efficiency improvements. So it was a big step for this group, as I mentioned. It took 2 years to get to yes. EPA was very impressed that a group with this diversity could reach agreement on specific recommendations. I think it gave the group some interest and momentum to move forward now in 2014, and we're focusing on two major things. Obviously, responding to the EPA rule. Anything the group says with respect to the proposed EPA rule will be on a consensus basis, in other words, full agreement of all the participants. And we have begun modeling the efficacy and cost effectiveness of a whole range of compliance options. And those have been mentioned, so I won't go into detail. You see there the five basic buckets that the group is looking at, ways that states could work together to achieve these reductions moving forward. The first one, unit by unit, is still possible under the rule, but the stringency of the proposed rule is high enough that we can't get to the reductions that would be required under the proposed rule just unit by unit, but it could be part of the package. Then, for example, what Xcel has proposed, which is a portfolio approach where you take advantage of the things that the state and the regulated companies are already doing and have those count towards achieving the reduction. A rate-based standard with trading, so basing the reduction on a rate of reduction and then trading credits, for example, to meet that reduction. Or a mass-based approach to trading, which would be like the SOX and NOx trading programs, but applying it to carbon emissions. And then finally, what Great River Energy has proposed, which is to work through a regional transmission organization such as MISO and to achieve the emissions reductions through generator dispatch in the wholesale electricity market. All I'll say here is, in the interest of time, the group has some real common sense criteria that they're using to evaluate these options and to make recommendations to Minnesota and other states. And then I'll end here with just giving you a bit of a taste of next steps in the region. And I want to emphasize that this is completely at the discretion of state regulatory officials in Minnesota and other states that are involved. But at the end of April, with the support of Minnesota officials and stakeholders, others participating in the collaborative, and a steering committee on which David Thornton serves with others, state officials from a majority of the MISO states came together in Chicago at the end of April and had an initial very careful exploratory discussion about whether states might want to work together. And at this point, they've made no decisions, but they wanted to await the proposed rule that, of course, is now out. And early next week, they'll be meeting in St. Louis and continuing that discussion about whether to work together in some formal capacity. So, you know, at a future date, we'll be able to say more. And then just in closing, I'll just highlight three, I think, a really important conclusion that the Midwestern Collaborative, something that's really important for the future. There's agreement among a broad set of interests, not only within Minnesota but across the region, that we need flexible compliance beyond just the individual power plant level, that we need to have all the tools in the toolkit. And there hasn't always been agreement from industry to the environmental community on that point, but we have it now. A recognition that that it's important for states and companies in their early action to receive credit. And then almost a state's rights approach to achieving these outcomes, having, again, this full spectrum of interests on board. So with that, I'll just end with pointing out that, again, as I said at the beginning, but for Minnesota's leadership within your own state and your state officials and stakeholders consistently supporting engagement with your neighbors, despite a lot of the tensions and difficulties in that, we wouldn't be where we are today. So thank you for that leadership. And
thank you, Mr. Crabtree.
Yep.
Questions? Anyone on the board? Mr. Napstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crabtree, I wonder, did the group come to a consensus on where the bar would be set when you discuss cost efficiency? You've discussed investment. You've alluded to cost efficiency. I'm wondering how that was determined. What is cost efficient? Is it a rate per kilowatt or a size of investment? Can you elaborate on that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knapp said that's a great question. They have not defined cost efficiency or cost effectiveness. We are doing some modeling now, and so, you know, obviously modeling is subject to all the assumptions and uncertainties that go with modeling, but we will have real numbers from modeling to suggest different costs to different compliance approaches, and then I think we'll start to have a better feel for what people feel are reasonable costs for given environmental outcomes. But at this point, I unfortunately can't answer your question. But if you look at the participation of the group, I think you can, given who's at the table, there's not a real appetite for unnecessary expenditure. I think people really want to see in the group and their agreement on this that we need to achieve these environmental results with the minimum cost possible. I mean, I think that's the general sense of the group, that that's both important on the merits, but it's also important for the viability of the policy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there another presenter? Mr. Walensky is next.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Welcome,
Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, I've spoken with your staff. When Mr. Grant talked to me about presenting today, I think that was the day the rule came out. I think I had no clue how complex this might be. And in order to make sure we could be more responsive to your questions, Mr. Frank Prager, who is our Vice President of Environmental Policy and Strategy and who's been working on carbon issues for our company for over 10 years now, I thought would be a little more helpful. So I'm just a sideshow here, and if that's okay, I'll turn over to Mr. Prager.
Welcome, Mr. Prager.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's great to be here today. Xcel Energy, as you know, is the largest power provider in Minnesota, but we also serve seven other states throughout the entire country. As a result of that, we have a perspective on this rule that stretches beyond the state of Minnesota, but I think Minnesota's perspective is very important when we look at where the rule is. I'm proud of what Xcel Energy has done in Minnesota. I think Scott is as well, as is our CEO, Ben Folk. We've accomplished a lot here on the environment, and we've done so at a reasonable price. Xcel Energy across the nation is right now the number one wind provider among utilities, and in Minnesota, we have 1,867 megawatts of wind currently online. That represents an investment of about $3.6 billion in wind energy. We're a leader in emission reduction programs, and many of you may remember the Minnesota Emission Reduction Program, or the MERP, which we implemented here in the Twin Cities several years ago. That retired 650 megawatts of coal fire generation and replaced it with natural gas combined cycle. Again, most of our investments in clean energy are measured in the billions, and that's true for this project as well. It was a $1 billion project. We've spent about $500 million on energy efficiency over the last 10 years, and we have right now we're meeting and actually exceeding in most years the 1.5% energy efficiency goal the state has. The result of that is since 2005, and if you remember from Commissioner Thornton's presentation, 2005 was essentially the baseline year that the president is using for purposes of designing this policy. From 2005, we have already achieved a 23% reduction in CO2 at Xcel Energy. We are on track, given some of the things that are coming up, to get to 31% within Minnesota by 2020, which is about the equivalent of what we're doing across our entire system, including Colorado, Texas, and our other operating states. And again, very important to us, we're doing that while maintaining reasonably priced power. The company right now is on track to meet the requirements of the Next Generation Energy Act here in Minnesota. So we're doing the things that we need to do to start moving the state in the direction we need to go, and we are, I think, doing that in all of the states in which we operate. We've learned a lot about how climate policy ought to work from this experience. A few things we've learned that I think are important for EPA. One is that there is extreme importance in being able to work flexibly on programs that meet the needs of a particular state or a particular set of customers. We have and are blessed with across our entire system great wind energy resources right in our backyard. And so we've been taking advantage of those over the last several years. Here in Minnesota, with all the wind we've added, we've had great resources down on the Buffalo Ridge in southwestern Minnesota. And the same thing happens across all of our systems. We also have been working a lot with our local stakeholders to find solutions that work for the people that we serve. And that's been a very important part of the approach that we've been advocating to EPA, making sure that, again, along the lines of Brad's states' rights approach, making sure that states continue to have the ability to design energy programs that meet their particular needs while we're trying to achieve the nation's carbon goals. We've been talking with EPA for quite a while about what to do with Section 111D. We've been talking for over 3 years to EPA, and we've been telling them two basic messages. The first is to make sure that you maintain state flexibility. State flexibility is a key piece to the effectiveness of the rule. And the second has been the issue of early action and ensuring that the things that we've already done that our customers are already paying for are credited because they are moving forward and moving the nation forward and achieving the emission reductions goals. And, in fact, we have more to come. Right now the company is on a path to add an additional 750 megawatts of wind on our system. We are also in the process of retiring 278 megawatts of coal at our Black Dog facility, also here not far from where we are today. And we're continuing our investment in energy efficiency. So with that as background and with the things we've done as background, we've taken a look at the rule. And we've been trying to study it. As Commissioner Thornton indicated, it's extremely complicated. And we're still trying to understand its implications, not only for our company, but also for the states we serve, including Minnesota. And frankly, the implications aren't yet clear to us. There are some questions that we need to get answered from EPA as well. We will say we're very pleased that EPA did recognize in the rule the importance of flexibility. It appears to us that EPA will grant states broad flexibility to design programs that meet the particular needs of the states, and that is good news. That is extremely good news. That was not a foregone conclusion when this process started, so it's to their credit that the EPA folks have recognized the importance. We are a bit concerned, as Commissioner Thornton indicated, that the early actions that we have taken are not fully recognized by the rule. And it seems to us that the targets that were set for the state of Minnesota are more ambitious than they would have been had we not undertaken some of these requirements. And so we are going to continue to work with EPA to try to address those issues as we go through the comment period. We have already reached out to EPA, and the EPA has been positive in saying that the agency is willing to listen to our concerns. We're going to continue to try to work with them as things go forward and hopefully be able to address some of the concerns that I've raised about the rule while retaining the things that we think really do work in the rule and come up with a positive approach for Minnesota and for the country. That's all I have to say, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have about particulars associated with the rules.
Thank you. Mr. Prager, Mr. Walensky, put Xcel directly on the spot, but multi-state initiatives or regional approaches, what's your take on the value of considering those? And Mr. Crabtree said you're part of the conversation of a regional conversation. What's your view on that?
Well, it's an extremely important consideration. It's one that EPA asked us to look at out here in the states, and we certainly are doing that. I think Eric will talk about a very innovative idea that he has working with MISO. At the same time, this rule is extraordinarily complicated just for one state. And so finding a way to work across many states is going to represent, at the very least, a political challenge. For us, though, as a multi-state utility, I mean, we serve Minnesota, we serve South Dakota, we serve North Dakota, and through our exchange agreement, we serve Wisconsin just out of the northern part of our system. It would be valuable for us to find some way to integrate the solutions we have just as we integrate the provision of energy that we provide. Question is whether we can do that, and that's something that we're going to be working on not only through the comment period here through this year, but as Commissioner Thornton indicated, all the way up to the point that the states submit their plans.
Thank you. Just speaking on behalf of our agency as responsible for submitting a plan at the end of this conversation, I appreciate that willingness to stay in the dialogue with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe a little bit more detailed question, but kind of similarly, I was curious about your comment when you said you've had was it 23% or clarify that, and you think you're on a 31% carbon reduction by 2020 for, was that Minnesota? And then how does that compare to the other states that you're, and you indicated it wasn't the same, so just roughly.
Xcel Energy has four operating companies, and because we operate NSP Wisconsin in the same vein as in Northern States Power Minnesota, which is our affiliate here in the north, we view that as one big system. That system is right now achieved a 23% reduction in CO2 tonnage, not emission rate. We haven't calculated emission rate, but in tons between 2005 and 2013, basically. And we're on track to get to 31%. Our affiliate in Colorado is on track to get to 35%, probably because it had a little more coal to start. We don't have nuclear plants in Minnesota. We've had a little bit less in Texas. But overall, when you look at overall Xcel Energy, we're on track to achieve about a 31% reduction in CO2 by 2030. So, you know, I'm sorry, 2020. So we're actually going to be, as a system, meeting the president's goal 10 years early. The question becomes, how does that translate into the way the state rules will be implemented, and can we find a way to make sure that the investments that our customers are already paying for are appropriately recognized in the rule? And that's one of the things we'll be working on as we go through the rulemaking process.
Thank you.
One last question, because Commissioner Thornton brought it up, Sherco 3 and company's plans for Sherco 3 and your expectations for the future. What comments might you have regarding that? I know there have been a lot of interest in that unit from the future.
We had Sherco 3 is the largest unit at Sherco. It's the newest one. It's the unit that I believe went on the mid 80s, and it's a about 950 megawatts. So it's a big unit. It's the biggest coal unit in the state of Colorado, and I think one of the biggest in the upper Midwest.
Minnesota.
I'm sorry, state of Minnesota. I apologize. My heart wants to go home, apparently. but it is an extremely large unit. And that unit was offline because of a very serious accident that occurred in 2012. So as a result, in 2011, it was off throughout 2012. As a result of the unit being offline, it didn't make it into EPA's baseline. And we're still evaluating what that means. And because of some of the unique ways in which EPA did the calculation, in particular with the capacity factor on the combined cycle units, it appears that maybe the impact wasn't quite as great as we had originally anticipated. But it's too early to really say what those numbers mean, and so we're continuing to look at that.
Thank you. All right, let's transition to our next presenter, Mr. Olson, is that correct?
That's correct.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm Eric Olson, Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy. For those of you who don't know us, Great River Energy is an electric generation and transmission cooperative. We're headquartered in Maple Grove here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We serve pretty much exclusively Minnesota. Just one of our co-ops serves a small part of Wisconsin. So we have 28 electric distribution cooperative as our member owners. We serve about one-third of Minnesota's population and about two-thirds of its land area. As Mr. Thornton mentioned earlier, we have generating resources in North Dakota, although we serve Minnesota. We have three different power plants, coal-fired power plants in North Dakota that total a combined 1,400 megawatts approximately. We do have other generation resources as well, mostly located in Minnesota. We have about 1,300 megawatts of gas-fired peaking generating facilities. Those are all located in Minnesota. 470 megawatts of wind purchases, about 300 megawatts of which are located in Minnesota. We have a 31-megawatt renewable waste-to-energy facility in Elk River. We have about 200 megawatts in large hydro purchases from up north from our neighbors in Canada. And we're building about 650 kilowatts of new solar, some of which you could see if you came to our headquarters building in Maple Grove. Great River Energy has long anticipated that existing coal-fired generation would be regulated by the EPA, as Chair Stein mentioned earlier. The Supreme Court ruled in 2007 that CO2 is a pollutant, and EPA has steadily taken the steps necessary to give it the legal authority to regulate, and they've chosen to regulate under 111D. So knowing it was coming, we've prepared at Great River Energy for the rule. One of the actions that we've taken is we've accelerated the depreciation on our Coal Creek Station and Stanton Stations power plants in North Dakota to make sure that that in the event that we need to do something with those plants, we don't have significant stranded investment. We've also reduced our CO2 emissions by about 20% from 2005 levels. As Mr. Crabtree mentioned, we've been part of the Midwest Power Sector Collaborative. We've also been involved in other groups, including one, a group, a coalition of nationwide electric utilities that Xcel is also involved in that's been working on this issue. As Mr. Crabtree and Mr. Prager have both mentioned, in that process, Great River Energy developed an idea for a regional market solution through the MISO market for implementation of whatever rules EPA might come up with. And we were able, in the process of coming up with that idea, in addition to talking to all state officials and the environmental groups and the other utilities, were able to meet with EPA to talk about those ideas. And to their credit, they have authorized compliance or implementation of the rule through regional programs. So we've been involved. Now, I think it's safe to say that the rule, until it was issued a couple of weeks ago, was a pretty well-kept secret. And we didn't know that different states were going to be treated so differently, frankly. Now, in our case, because we have North Dakota-fired power plants, that was fortuitous. The North Dakota percentage reduction under the rule in carbon intensity is 11%. We're well positioned to meet that. We're already reducing CO2 at our largest coal-fired power plant, Coal Creek Station, by 4%, and that's with our patented dry fining coal refining technology, and that also reduces other emissions. By the way, we've been working on licensing that. We've signed a license agreement for that technology with China, and this rule may actually make licensing of that technology in the U.S. more attractive. In addition, on November 1st of this year, our Spiritwood Station combined heat and power plant near Jamestown, North Dakota, will go online. That plant, because it's a combined heat and power plant and because we'll have two purchasers of processed steam from that plant, is about twice as efficient as a conventional coal-fired power plant and about half as carbon intense, and also will further reduce carbon intensity through the use of dry-fined coal that we will rail down to that facility from our Coal Creek Station where it's refined. In Minnesota, we think we're also well positioned. We own in Minnesota a generation that's exclusively low and no carbon, and that's actually really very common to the other generation and transmission cooperatives that have members in Minnesota. The typical generation portfolio in Minnesota for those folks is really mostly wind and the like. In addition, we are fully compliant with the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standard and will stay so, and have always been able to meet the 1.5% conservation improvement goal in Minnesota. So we think that we are well positioned for our members and to serve our members, and that's important for you to know as regulators in Minnesota. But individual utility and state compliance isn't the whole story here. In this world of interconnectedness of our industry, no utility is an island. And notwithstanding state authority under the Clean Air Act to issue state implementation plans, no state is an island either. The MISO region is heavily reliant on coal, as Mr. Crabtree outlined earlier. And all utilities here that are members rely on that market. And we rely on it for reliable energy for our members. We're not solely in control of that. We need to rely on the market for reliable energy. And we're also reliant on the market to provide efficient prices for us. So we are taking a look at the rule, and it's really too early to judge it about its impacts generally on reliability and affordability for Minnesota consumers and regionally and nationally as well. The task of analyzing the rule with respect to reliability and affordability is made much more difficult by the creative approach that EPA chose to use with very different targets for each state and a tremendous amount of flexibility built in. Now, we think the flexibility certainly will help with respect to reliability and affordability. It's not just a question of more efficient coal plants or shutting down coal plants. There's a lot of flexibility, and that should help. So as we go forward, we will be working with MISO. We're working with our power marketer, which is a coalition of generation and transmission cooperatives nationwide, to analyze that. We're working with other utilities. We're members of the Midwest Power Sector Collaborative. We're involved there as well. And, of course, we are going to be participating very directly with the state of Minnesota and keeping the lines of communication open there, as well as the state of North Dakota, whose state implementation plan will obviously affect us greatly. So we expect it to be a really busy 120 days from today's date before the comments are due on about October 16th, and we will work with everybody to make comments that are in the interests of our members and consumers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions? Very good. Thank you so much. And if the staff members could come forward for the next panel presentation, and then we'll move on to the comment period. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. We're going to the comment period first. My mistake. Let us, given the number of folks interested, I've got about 9 or 10 people now. We're gonna have to limit our time to about 3 to 4 minutes. 3 minutes, please. So I'm going to begin with Karen Monahan from the Sierra Club. Come on up, sure. Yep. Please come forward.
You may want to have them on deck so that the.
And the next speaker will be Robert Tamman from Sudan. Welcome, Ms. Monahan.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for allowing us to have a time to comment on this. So as Minnesota begins to think about how it's going to implement the Clean Power Plan, Sierra Club encourages the state to set science-based carbon reduction levels necessary to stave off climate change. EPA's Clean Power Plan only represents the floor of what Minnesota should achieve by 2030. But the goal is not going to be sufficient to address stave off climate change. Minnesota has always been a leader when it comes to addressing carbon pollution, and it should continue that leadership by implementing a state carbon goal of 80% by 2050. Minnesota is well positioned to meet or exceed EPA's carbon goals. First, there are three large coal fire power plants, which are reasonable for approximately 85% of Minnesota's power plant carbon emissions. Gradually phasing out those coal fire power plants or a number of their older units will significantly bring down carbon emissions. Specifically, Minnesota can substantially comply with a 40.5% carbon reductions requirement by phasing out Taconite Harbor Units 1 and 2, Clay Boswell Units 1 and 2, and Sherburne County's Units 1 and 2 plants, and replacing those units with majority clean energy. These reductions through retirement will complement other programs that Minnesota already has in place, all of which will be part of its individual or regional plan to reduce carbon pollution, including the Next Generation Energy Act, which requires both electric and natural gas, renewable energy portfolio standards applicable to the various utilities in the state, and the Minnesota State Building Codes, which increase energy efficiency for residential and commercial buildings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Monahan, for your brevity and for coming before the board today. As Mr. Tamman moves forward, if Sammy Arderoe, I'm going to butcher that name. So Sammy will be next up, and if you would come to the table and sit next. So as I announce your name, please come forward, and then we'll make the transition a little bit more smoothly. Mr. Tamman, welcome to the board.
Thank you. I'm Bob Tamman from Sudan, Minnesota. The final grind is the consistency of face powder. Whether it's in the iron mine dry work for several years or the proposed sulfide mining industry, to get those minerals, you have to grind it to face powder. Now, we've heard a lot today about tweaking the methods by which we produce power. And I realize perhaps that isn't quite your mission today to talk about consumption, but I believe the realities of the market, that if we keep permitting these energy pigs, we are going to have a difficult time regulating the supply. I would also point out that a lot of Minnesota's carbon is sequestered in our wetlands. Thousands of acres of wetlands destroyed for the mining industry. And as we go forward with this process, I hope you'll remember that mining is a wetland killer, it's an energy pig, and I believe economically it's a net liability to the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tamman. Sammy, and then the next speaker will be George Crocker.
Good afternoon.
Could you introduce, say your last name for me?
Sure. I'm sorry. My name is Sammy Ardito Rivera.
Thank you.
Yes, and I'm here representing the Center for Earth, Energy, and Democracy. My colleagues are at some meetings, ironically, about climate in Chicago, so I'll be reading a letter on their behalf. The Center for Earth, Energy, and Democracy thanks you for the opportunity to comment on the proposed new power plant rules as Minnesota now begins to formulate its state implementation plan under the Clean Air Act. We have been encouraged by the Environmental Quality Board's initial steps in incorporating environmental justice principles and practices into the climate strategies and economic opportunities analysis, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's proactive work in moving to address environmental harms and related health disparities that are disproportionately occurring within Minnesota's communities of color, low-income communities, and tribal nations. We are hopeful that the Environmental Quality Board will encourage these initial efforts and the continued incorporation of environmental justice across all other state agencies. Our comments on the new power plant rules are an acknowledgement that climate change is a critical problem that is already disproportionately affecting our communities. As communities in Minnesota that are on the front lines of climate change, we are your strong allies in ensuring our energy sector is on a path towards sustainability. Thus, we stand in full support of regulations that require strong and stringent reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. As Minnesota moves forward in developing its state implementation plan for the new power plant rule, we provide the following comments. One, ensure that the participation of the most of those most impacted by climate change, namely American Indian tribal nations and communities, communities of color, and low-income communities, in the development of compliance mechanisms is a top priority. This means effective consultation and engagement in all processes and decision-making relative to state implementation plans. Two, all compliance options must undergo a robust analysis of the distribution of costs and benefits in terms of geography, race, and income. These analyses must explicitly address the potential of increased co-pollutant hotspots of each compliance mechanism proposed at the system-wide or regional level. Co-benefits, the potential result of improving the health of communities through reduction of co-pollutants of each policy option, must also be included. Three, compliance options must not result in the expansion or further life extension of Minnesota's nuclear energy facilities or result in imports of large hydropower. Expansion of the clean power sector that has the greatest potential for local green job creation in communities with high unemployment and underemployment should be prioritized. Four, accountability, monitoring, verification, and enforcement must be paramount in the implementation plan design. Thank you, and we look forward to hearing how you'll be moving forward and meeting our joint goals of ensuring the health of our communities, our economy, and our environment. And this is Roxanne O'Brien, who would also like to make a quick comment.
Welcome, Ms. O'Brien.
Thank you. Since I'm not on the list, I'm not going to take too much of your time. But I did just want to give a shout out to the young people who came today to show you that they're here and that they're watching and that they want to be included as well as other people in our communities, because we're tired of seeing a lot of businesses reap all the money and resources of our community. And when our resources are now disappearing, we're the ones who have to pay for it in every way. And yet they're still trying to figure out how to make more money when we're all actually in tragedy. Like, so I'm hoping that you guys make the most humane decision when they come to the table and they're begging you to help them keep their profits, that you think about us who are lacking profits and lacking money and lacking resources, and yet we're not getting anything from this.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien, and thanks to those of you next generation folks, young folks that are here today before the board. We appreciate your presence and everyone in the audience who came today to hear this. Thank you, Ms. Ardero Rivera, and now Mr. Crocker is up next. Boise Jones is on the list, so if you would come forward. Welcome, Mr. Crocker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Crocker. I'm the executive director of the North American Water Office, which actually has been struggling with these issues since its inception in 1982. So it's with some degree of satisfaction that I sit here and say we're finally recognizing and acknowledging that pollution, particularly carbon dioxide, causes changes, that these changes have consequences, and that we're coming to the understanding that those consequences really aren't acceptable. But it really should be no surprise that we have all of this pollution because we reward it. The financial health of all of those industries that you've been listening to and you've been regulating for all of these years, that financial health, and it doesn't matter if it's an IOU or a municipal or a REA, that financial health is tied to the consumption of electricity. And the more consumption happens, the greater their financial health and the more pollution. So we have this problem because we reward it. I would submit that if you actually are serious about all of this flexibility and about getting to the heart of the problem, you stop rewarding the behavior that causes it. And that's really not so hard. You don't have to have utility systems that sell a commodity of kilowatt hour. You wouldn't know what to do with a kilowatt hour. You want a function performed. The real business is providing a service, and you could have rate designs that allow the financial health to be dependent on the efficient delivery of that service rather than on the wasteful consumption of a commodity that causes your problem. So get with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crocker. Ms. Boyce Jones?
Boyce.
Excuse me, Mr. Jones, for misspeaking. Next will be Peter Berglund. Welcome to the board.
Thank you. First, thank you to the commissioner for having this event today, the board members and stakeholders. My name is Boyce Jones. I'm just a private citizen, and I want to first say how pleased I am to be here to even talk about climate change, given the Koch brothers and GOP's intransigence on this issue, as well as our former governor who decided to run for president and pretty much shelve a great deal of work that a lot of Minnesotans did on this issue. So just to even be here, I think, is just an absolute charge I'm getting. I'm in support of this rule and the state of Minnesota's commitment to comply with the EPA rule. Minnesota's in a great position to retrofit the work of the Climate Change Advisory Group and the Department of Commerce's commitment that they've shown over the years to really be involved in doing this work. My community is behind these efforts if outreach and education is highlighted in your continued effort to comply with this rule. We think that that would give you better input and makes for a better work product in the end by including this population. As evidenced by looking to your left and to your right, people of color and people most harmed by the adverse impact of the economic and physical impacts of carbon and pollutants, they're not represented here. So please consider in your future work outreach to these populations. If not implemented with haste, these federal regulations could be rolled back, we fear, if a new Republican administration comes in. So my concern is, how do we insulate as a state the work that we do from future rollbacks by policies that could be primarily just by executive decision, executive order put into place? How do we insulate as a state the work that's been done? And is there indeed any teeth? Not just in, of course, we're in the draft stage, but will there be truly any teeth? What are the carrots? What are the sticks that will truly make it enforceable would be also something that we would look very closely at. We know, again, that Excel has, I think, done a really good job in their work to reach the kind of targets and the baselines that was set by the climate change group. But the ratepayer pays for all that as well. So we want to, again, make certain that in the future, since the ratepayer usually pays for the changes, the upgrades, and the missteps, that we can make certain that there are going to be some controls put into place that the ratepayer is not going to basically end up getting the shaft. And in closing, you know, there's a old Ibu saying that says, in the struggle between two elephants, it's the grass that suffers. You know, to me, those stakeholders are those kids in the back there who have to make the decisions to correct any mistake we make here, but also benefit from the work, again, that you do here. And again, thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Peter Berglund, and then on deck will be Betty Teisel. If she would come forward, please. Welcome.
Hi,
Mr. Berglund.
Peter Berglund here. I'm not a young person, but I'm glad the young people are here.
I'm an older person. I've got some gray hair, so I've got the experience of witnessing climate change firsthand over my five-plus decades. And I wanted to point out an article in the paper today, and I'm not looking at the million barrels of oil. It's the article on the bottom. The headline is, "Trapped Together by Flood, Trooper Leads Mom to Safety. Her life saved mere moments before." So she almost died in a flood situation. And so I want to point that out, because that's the kind of thing that's maybe not put into the calculations for cost-benefit analysis. I mean, we've got this poor woman. She almost died in a flood. We've lost other people in floods and other severe weather events. So that's key to remember in this whole discussion. Also, see, my comments are not, I didn't prepare ahead of time, so I'm just kind of winging it here a little bit, so I apologize. We've reached 400 parts per million, I think is the unit, 400 ppm of CO2 in the atmosphere. And so I hope we can put behind us this question of, is this man-made or is this natural? The point is we're here. We're at way too high a level of CO2 in the atmosphere. It doesn't matter anymore how we got here. What matters is that we need to stop pouring more and more CO2 into the atmosphere. And just a quick little story. Dr. Seeley talked about the extreme events. Back in the early 80s, my brother and I were explaining to my grandfather about climate change, and we said, well, the change may not be so great. You know, it might just be a few degrees. And this, like I say, this was back in the early 80s. And my grandfather, who came from the farm, he's a smart guy. And he goes, oh, but I bet the extremes will be worse, won't they? And that's what's happening, and that's what we need to worry about. That's what this poor lady almost died because of the extremes. So thank you for your work. This is serious business, and I hope we can do as much as we can to reduce the CO2.
Thank you, Mr. Berglund, for coming before the board today.
Yeah. Oh, I'm here on vacation time, so I've taken my own personal time. This is serious to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the board, Ms. I'll let you pronounce your last name. I apologize.
My name is Betty Tissel. It's a good old Slovenian-American name.
Thank you.
So.
Carol Overland is next. Go ahead, Ms. Tissel.
Good afternoon. My name is Betty Tissel. I live in Minneapolis. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I've been to several hearings over the last year, and this is the first time I've actually gotten a chance to speak, so I really appreciate it. I'm not an expert. Well, I'm an expert at organizing community singing, but I'm not an expert on any of the issues that we're discussing today. But as I get older, I've seen that we've had a lot of experts, and look where we are. So that's why I'm pushing myself to try really hard to keep my head out of the sand and to challenge myself when opportunities like this come up. I just heard about this meeting yesterday thanks to Sammy Rivera, so thanks, Sammy. I will be brief, but I wanted to ask a question. I noticed the phrase demand-side management that several of the speakers used. And I'm wondering if that is that the same thing as conservation, or does that include conservation? Would anyone want to quickly?
I believe it includes conservation, and it expands beyond that. So the okay. Reduction of demand.
Because I feel that we never hear the word conservation anymore, and people don't ask us to conserve. And so the two things that I want to ask you to consider as you work towards helping Minnesota achieve these EPA goals is to ask citizens to do more to conserve, because nobody's really asking us to do that. No leaders are asking us to do that. And to help us do more to conserve and help us find ways to participate more in renewable energy projects. My family last year was able to install a 16-panel solar project at our house, And I just looked at the gauge before I came up to speak, and at this moment we were producing 10 times the energy we were using at our house. But that's only possible because my family was able to afford the down payments and take advantage of the really limited pool of rebates that were available last year. And I think now the program has been changed and reduced so that it's even harder for people who don't have, who can't afford a down payment to do something like that. So please, please pay attention to helping citizens participate in renewable and asking citizens to do more and conserve. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ms. Tissel, for that testimony. And Ms. Overland is up next, and then following Ms. Overland is David Zemeta. Yes, thank you. Welcome to the board, Ms. Overland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am here as an impediment to transmission. You may ask, what does transmission have to do with this? But you're talking about coal and reduction of emissions, and we need to look at the policy aspect of what we've been doing over the last 20 years. This is transmission. This is transmission on steroids, and this is what we as Minnesotans have allowed to happen and what members of the entire meso region have allowed to happen. And it's about coal. We need to stop burning it. And note that 2005 is a baseline. That date has been mentioned often today. And that was before the recession. And that's a problem. We are producing significant less electricity. We are burning significantly lower amounts of coal because of the recession. Yet most of the speakers here today have a big interest in coal. Some of that is acknowledged. Xcel and GRE are some of the biggest coal burners we have here, but and also in North Dakota. But other speakers, like the Great Plains Institute, they have taken significant money to support transmission and coal gasification, too. Thankfully, they've cut back on that. But you need to look at every speaker that's coming up. What are their connections? How much have they received to promote coal, to promote transmission? We have now got billions of dollars of transmission going up in Minnesota. CapEx, that was about $7 billion. We have the whole project. We have another $5 billion that's now coming up. Two projects, one project already permitted, and these MVP projects, another one that's online right now in the application process. The transmission system, we have the generation starts at the northwest, goes to the southeast. These are the coal plants. We say the transmission is full. Well, if you cut down these coal plants, there'd be plenty of room for all sorts of other kinds of generation and all sorts of other backup generation when the wind isn't blowing or when solar isn't working. So adding this new transmission is not helping us at all, and I ask you to look at the policy impacts of more transmission. And you say, well, there won't be any more transmission, but if you look at, I mean, more coal generation, but if you look at that next generation energy decision that came down just recently, that specifically says, and I've included that in the handout, they're looking at a dry fork coal plant that was in the Western Interconnect has now been moved to the Eastern Interconnect. It's coming now this way. We looked at there's new plans for a coal plant in South Dakota, an additional unit in Dry Fork, surplus at Milton Young. It's got to go from somewhere, and it's coming down here. All this transmission is giving this coal access to the market. When you hear about market solutions, think about what this transmission system that Minnesota has allowed provides. It provides a lot of opportunity for more generation, more CO2 emissions, and I ask you to take a look at that.
Thank you, Ms. Overland. Mr. Zemeta, and then Alan Muller. Welcome to the board.
Thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today. My name is David Zemeta. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. My council includes 17 diverse interests appointed by the governor and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, recognizing the tribes as separate nations. Council's charged by state statute with advising the governor, the legislature, and federal, state, county, and local governments on sustainable forest policies and practices. In 2008, As directed by the Minnesota Legislature, my council published the first state-level guidelines in the United States for sustainable harvest of woody biomass for energy from forests, brushlands, and open lands across all public and private ownerships in Minnesota. I'll be very brief here. I have one request for you, and that request is to include the broad forest resources community in your deliberations, from the forest products industry to environmental groups to the tribes. And I leave you with one question, which I'm not necessarily looking for an answer to this question today, and that question is, how will the EPA 111B rule address emissions from existing power plants that use both fossil fuel and woody and or agricultural biomass? And I'll give you an example. Minnesota Power's plant in Grand Rapids uses about 20% coal and 80% woody biomass. How will a plant like that be affected by this rule? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Zemeta, for that comment. And thank you for writing down your question on your comment slip, too. That was helpful. Thank you. Mr. Mueller, and then Sam Neubauer is next.
Thank you. Before I make any comments, I'd like to note that there are many more young people in the back of the room than have signed up to speak. And if any of them feel at all moved to have something to say, I would urge you to come and fill out one of these cards and do that. The folks on the board won't bite you, and they need to hear from you more than they need to hear from me. Secondly, the issue that's being discussed this afternoon is one of central importance to the future of Minnesota. Indeed, it may be a survival issue. This room is equipped to webcast these meetings so that people all over the state could listen and perhaps participate. All of the meetings of the MPCA Citizens Board are so webcast, and I've urged the EQB before to use the equipment that's already sitting here to broadcast its meetings, and I want to repeat that request, and I think I'll try to keep repeating it until it happens. With all due respect, I think it's almost a no-brainer that that should be happening. There were a number of invited presentations today. I felt that one of them was credible. That was Mr. Seeley's telling us that we have a problem, a real problem with climate change. All of the other presentations, noticeably including those from the PCA, came from the point of view that the name of the game is to minimize the impact of this already very weak EPA rule, to figure out how to game the system so that we can claim compliance without really having to do anything or spend any money, to get EPA to back off on its expectations for Minnesota relative to other states. And I want to suggest to you that this is all the wrong approach. We should be looking at how to maximize the benefit to the state of this rule by doing everything that we can to reduce climate forcing emissions, not to dodge the bullet, because we can't dodge the bullet. The bullet's here. And we need to use all the tools that we have to react to it in a responsible way. Just about 2 years ago, I sat in this room with a bunch of other people at a hearing on a rulemaking instituted by the Pollution Control Agency. And this was to raise the regulatory threshold for CO2 emissions from 100 tons a year to 100,000 tons a year. And I and a number of other people sat in this room at this table and gave testimony that this was going in the wrong direction, that we needed all of the tools that we have to regulate power plant emissions, and we shouldn't be giving them away with misguided rulemakings. Well, those of us who testified got the middle finger from the PCA, and that decision was made. Now, a little bit less than 2 years later, I was able to sit in this room and listen to Mr. Thornton talking about needing the ability to make enforceable requirements for carbon emissions. And what I want to get at here, and I don't mean this as a criticism of anyone in particular, but the PCA and the other executive agencies of Minnesota's government totally fail to have a coherent narrative on global warming. Every decision that's made that I see that has a climate impact is made on a tactical basis without obvious consideration of what should be the larger policy issue. And I know there are reasons for that. Every program has its own underlying statute and regulations. It has its own funding. It has its own habits and traditions. And those are not easy to change. But I don't see how the MPCA, DNR, the PUC, the Department of Commerce Energy Shop can make the contribution that needs to be made if they can't get their own internal act together. And I could sit here for a long time and roll out examples, but I'll just share one with you.
Mr. Muller, you're out of time, so if you could wrap up, I'd appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, I can't imagine that you don't want me to give me a little bit more time under the circumstances, but I will shut up with the comment that we have heard from the Great Plains Institute and perhaps some GRE, the suggestion that environmental interests were in accordance with their recommendations. And I don't doubt that that segment of the environmental community that is funded and controlled by utility interests might well be aligned with those recommendations. But there are many other people involved in environmental advocacy who would consider the Great Plains Institute's recommendations to be disastrously off track and misguided. Okay, thank you for your interest in my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Muller. Mr. Neubauer. Welcome to the board.
Thank you. Thank you so much for holding this meeting today. My name is Sam Neubauer. I'm a student from Carleton College on in Northfield. I live by Lake Calhoun. And I'm a fellow with Minnesota 350. And I'm coming today. There are two points that I wanted to make. The first about kind of an environmental justice perspective, and the second about Minnesota as a leader on climate change. The first is I really appreciate like the work that the Great Plains Institute has been doing, but it seems to me that a lot of the conversation today, I heard disproportionate impacts, but that was basically saying that Minnesota, and this was earlier in the presentation, was being more affected than surrounding areas. But I think it's also important to recognize that currently in Minnesota, low-income communities and communities of color are way disproportionately impacted by climate change and by the current fossil fuel infrastructure. If we look at where coal plants are sourced, they happen to be sourced in areas where there are communities of color and low-income communities, and these communities that are already marginalized are facing the greatest rates of asthma. And so we have a really incredible opportunity at this point when we're changing our fossil fuel infrastructure, when we're trying to decide how we want to cut emissions, to cut them in a way that's equitable so that it's not targeting communities of color and not targeting low-income communities, but maybe we can balance things out now so that we're not being discriminatory in our energy infrastructure. I think that's a really important thing, something the kids spoke to earlier today or the other youth spoke to today, and it's like critically important. The other is that Minnesota, we also heard about today how Minnesota is getting kind of penalized for having been a leader, but we were a leader because we thought that climate change was a problem. We were a leader because we recognized as a state that this was something that was critically important to us. And so why do we have to be concerned that we're going to have to make changes? We should be saying, this is great what the EPA has done, but why don't we make even greater changes and continue to be a leader in, like Minnesota can be a leader for the United States on stopping climate change. This is critically important as a youth member. This is the planet that I'll be living on, and I know that 50 years from now, many of y'all may not be around, but I will. And I'd like a planet to live on. There's an exclusion. But I think it's important to recognize that, you know, we have to be a leader on climate change as a state of Minnesota. And we've been great on that. And it's like really, really important that we continue to do so. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Neubauer, for speaking up and for coming forward. And to all who testified and provided comments, we do appreciate your input. And the staff of the EQB, I know, are always willing to talk with you about concerns, comments outside of this meeting. Those of you who did not necessarily sign up or have something prepared to say, please do connect with, through Mr. Seufert, the executive director, the staff members of EQB, if you would like to have additional comments for this subcommittee of EQB. With that, now it is time to wrap up with the staff presentation about ongoing activities that the state is engaged in to meet our statutory greenhouse gas reduction goals, and team of folks that are going to make that presentation. And Ms. Henderson, are you taking the lead on this?
Yeah.
Very well. Welcome to the board.
Chair and members of the board, my name is Anna Henderson. I am staff for the Environmental Quality Board, and I want to echo what has been said about the youth presence at this meeting. I'm really glad to see them here, and I would have loved to see every single one of them comment, and I hope that they continue to talk with us and work with us. And as Commissioner Stein said, I'm happy to meet with anybody and talk more about these issues. Chair and members of the board, this is a timeline of climate and clean energy related efforts going on across state agencies. This is a very short timeline, just from June through the end of the year. And you can see that there are a lot of things that are going on, and you're going to be hearing about all of them on this panel right now. So there is a lot of work, and it's the role of the Environmental Quality Board to coordinate all of these efforts. The EQB makes sure that the efforts are made accessible to the public, that they leverage each other's strengths, and we make sure that all the perspectives are considered. We need to consider the environmental perspective, the economic perspective, the health perspective, and the social justice perspective. As you can see, a number of reports and communication pieces will be coming out this fall. These will detail what climate change means in Minnesota and economic opportunities for clean energy. And I just want to point out, there's an event on there next month for a clean energy summit that's going to be held at the University of Minnesota campus, and it's going to be led by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'm going to talk briefly in my time about the climate solutions and economic opportunity work that EQB is leading. You can see on here this work, it has already been going on, and we are in the middle of analysis right now, and there will be a public stakeholder process in the early fall. This project is looking at Minnesota-specific strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in major sectors of our economy. The project is building off of 2008 Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group work, and the modeling will again be done by the Center for Climate Change Strategies, who the state worked with in 2008. This work includes the electric sector, and we expect that our results will help inform the 111D discussion about reducing carbon emissions from power plants, but it also looks at other sectors of our economy. So it will be looking at transportation, agriculture, our residential and commercial buildings, forests, and industries in Minnesota. The study was designed through a process of interagency collaboration and public input. At the end of March, we held a public EQB Climate Subcommittee meeting where we took comments and we held an open dialogue about the policies that were looked at in the 2008 process. And we also talked about new ideas that hadn't been examined in 2008. Our overall aim for this work is to inform the public and policymakers as they look for ways to grow our economy and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The first part of this analysis is a microeconomic analysis, and it's going to assess the potential for each of the policy options to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it's also going to assess the societal costs and savings that we could have through these different policy options. The second part of the analysis is the macroeconomic analysis. And in the 2008 study, we didn't do this portion of the study, so this will be a new added layer to what we know from then. And this work is going to be looking at the projected indirect effects of policy options on net jobs, on income, on economic growth, on state productivity, and on rates and prices. And a really important part of this analysis is a fairness and equity analysis on how those impacts are going to be distributed across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grant, are you next?
Yes, I believe so. Mr. Chairman, can you get the next set of slides up? It is. And maybe I can have that. So thanks very much. I'm going to talk a little bit about another of the efforts that are underway at the same time as the what we now affectionately refer to as CZEO, the Climate Strategies and Economic Opportunities work that Anna just described, and also so bring to your attention the work of that we're doing under an award from the National Governors Association. We were one of four states selected to participate in the Department of Energy's Clean Energy Economy Policy Academy with leadership, and this is co-led by the Department of Employment and Economic Development and Department of Commerce, with assistance from Agriculture, the EQB, and others. The goal is really to better integrate our economic development activities with our clean energy policy strategies. And while we've been doing great work in both of these areas for a long time, we haven't necessarily married the two efforts in a way that really maximizes both. And that's really the goal of this effort. The scope of the project is really to focus on five business sectors that are very robust within the Minnesota economy: wind energy, solar energy efficiency, bioenergy, and that includes all of the ways in which we use bioproducts and biomass, from generating electricity to creating biofuels and other innovative approaches. And then finally, a kind of a catch-all bucket that includes smart grid, energy storage, all kinds of new technologies. This one is a little bit hard to get our arms around, but it clearly represents an important business sector within Minnesota. We want to consider the entire value chain for each of these sectors, so everything from R&D to manufacturing, the installation of this of these technologies, and all of the support services that go along with providing them, everything from legal services to what have you. So one of the real goals then of the project is to get a better picture than we have now of how these assets really are deployed in Minnesota, and to really dig a little bit deeper than we've been able to before at all of the business energy sectors that are actually involved in each of these five larger sectors. The goals of that, of course, are to create jobs, keep energy dollars here in the state and working in the state, building a network for businesses. We see in a lot of these business sectors that the folks that work in them, the companies that do business in them, really don't work together at all. They don't work together to support their own interests as a business community. There are exceptions to that, but that's a fairly general situation. We want to help existing companies grow, obviously, and we really want to understand and predict what the workforce demands and opportunities are going to be. What kind of training are we going to need to provide the workforce that's going to be employed in these sectors out into the future? And another point that I am kind of a broken record on is we really want to be able to know if we make investments in clean energy, or we change our state policy to make clean energy opportunities more available, exactly how many jobs are we going to produce in doing so? Not just in the most obvious ways. We see wind turbines go up. We know how many people it took to do it. But everything that was required all the way along the supply chain in order to do that. And we don't have a good way of making those estimates now, and hope that this effort will really help us with that. As Anna mentioned, the other aspect of this work is really to engage with businesses that are involved in these sectors. We're doing a survey of businesses now for For this purpose, we're going to be meeting, and some of these meetings have already taken place, with the five sectors in roundtables this month. And then Anna mentioned the Clean Energy Economy Summit that is planned for July 17th at the University of Minnesota. I know all of the commissioners have been invited to that. We really hope to see you there. And we will then be submitting recommendations to the governor from all of this work in September. I wanted to mention one other thing very quickly that is an effort that's related that you should be aware of, the Minnesota Renewable Integration Technical Study. This is really an effort to look at what would happen from a very technical perspective if we increased our state's renewable energy standard from the current 25 by 25 to something much more aggressive in the 40 or 50% range. And what impacts would that have on reliability? What kinds of solutions would we need to look at in order to accomplish that? The study team is comprised of utility engineers, national experts, and others working under the Department of Commerce's direction. And that study and the results from it are due in November of this year. So with that, I will turn it over to the next speaker.
Mr. Toner.
I just want to have Mr. Toner introduce himself. Sure. He's here for answering questions.
Yeah, hi, my name is Brandon Toner. I'm a project coordinator at DEED, and I've been working very closely with ANA, EQB, Commerce, and all the other partners on this NGA project, and I'm just here on hand to answer any specific questions about that NGA project and some of the research that we're doing. But I'll just comment that we're pulling together a great deal of multi-layered data resources to get a very accurate picture of where we stand here in Minnesota. So it's going to be really exciting when we get those results in. So,
thank you. And Ms. Robb.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Kristen Robb. I'm the Minnesota Climate and Health Director at the Minnesota Department of Health, and it is a pleasure to be here. I want to tell you about two documents that MDH is in the process of drafting, the Minnesota Climate and Health Profile and the Minnesota Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment. The purpose of developing these documents was to understand and describe the health impacts of climate change through an extensive review of information and data directly relevant to Minnesota, and then to provide information to local public health and other planners so that we are better prepared to respond to the changing climatic conditions and severe weather events that we are seeing. Both projects engaged a number of experts from state agencies, the State Climatology Office, as well as local public health departments and local elected officials. This is a list of just some of the experts that were engaged in the process, and I'd just like to thank any of those people that are in the room today. The draft Minnesota Climate and Health Profile explains how changes in the climate are leading to public health impacts and then further describes those potential health impacts. This is a really complicated diagram, and I'm not going to have a lot of time to spend going through it with you, but I just wanted to briefly talk about it. This diagram helps to illustrate the relationships between atmospheric changes and public health impacts, specifically highlighting extreme heat. That is, increases in greenhouse gas emissions, particularly carbon dioxide, are leading to increases in atmospheric temperatures, which in turn are leading to changes in precipitation and humidity. All of these atmospheric influences are directly or indirectly causing disruptions in four key aspects of the human environment, that is air, weather, water, and ecosystems. And these changes then are leading to situations that threaten the health and vitality of our communities through increasing air pollution and pollen, increasing heat, flood and drought events, increasing harmful algal blooms, and then also making certain habitats more hospitable to ticks and mosquitoes that carry diseases. This diagram specifically connects the dot between how increasing temperatures and high humidity are leading to extreme heat events that have both direct and indirect effects on public health. Direct effects include heat-related illnesses such as heat exhaustion, but other exacerbation of other diseases such as diabetes, heart, and respiratory diseases. And indirect effects include infrastructure failures such as power outages that can prevent people from using air conditioners and fans to cool off, and things like buckled roads that can impair emergency responders to reach people affected. So the profile is going to be used to educate public health professionals and the public on what the public health impacts are of climate change, and it is also being used in the health department to help prioritize our work. The companion document to the profile is the Minnesota Climate Change Vulnerability Assessment. The assessment reviewed scientific literature and existing data to assess the occurrence of climate hazards in Minnesota and then the populations that are vulnerable to each of these hazards. The climate hazards explored in the assessment were similar to those explored in the profile. They are listed here. The vulnerable populations were described and mapped for each of these hazards and included characteristics such as age, rates of certain diseases, socioeconomic characteristics including income, limited English speaking proficiency, employment in certain occupations, and households with no vehicles. The climate hazards and vulnerable populations were mapped at the county level. And for three of those climate hazards, extreme heat events, air pollution, and flooding, MDH created county-level composite vulnerability scores that combined both historical occurrence of the climate hazard and then the population vulnerability characteristics so that counties could see their total vulnerability for those climate hazards. The vulnerability assessment can be used by local public health departments and others to understand their historic risk of climate hazards and the vulnerabilities to certain populations in their county. This information can help those counties develop adaptation strategies and responses that are suitable to the hazards and the affected vulnerable populations in their communities. A major limitation to the vulnerability assessment is that the climate hazard occurrence information is based on historical data. So that may not reflect the likelihood of an event in the future. Also, vulnerable populations are based on current data, not predicted numbers. So communities that might be experiencing a growing elderly population, for example, that is not captured. Nonetheless, MDH feels that this will be a very valuable tool for local public health and others as they understand and try and plan for the impacts of climate change. The next steps for both projects are to finish vetting the documents and develop communication tools that we are going to share with local public health departments and the public. In the fall, we plan to visit the 8 state community health services advisory committee regions. They are shown on the map above. To listen to communities' comments about climate change, their struggles, their concerns, and then also share the report with those communities. We hope to conduct more focused vulnerability assessments, specifically with communities in greater Minnesota, because this is at the county level, not at a township or a city level. Many of the effects of climate change lie outside of the health department's control, so it is really critical to engage and coordinate the work of other agencies in both mitigating and adapting to climate change. We are really grateful for EQB's and Commerce's and Ag's leadership related to climate change mitigation and the work of PCA's Interagency Climate Adaptation Team to keep a coordinated effort between mitigation and adaptation at the state agencies. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Robb. In the interest of time, I think we'll wrap up this portion of our meeting, and thanks to the staff and to everyone who came forward with information today and presented. The work of the subcommittee will continue. Look forward to additional agendas where we'll be hearing updates from the work that we got just briefly reported today. Thank you, everyone. With that, we'll conclude the subcommittee, and we'll take a 5-minute break and then reconvene. Thank you.
Good work.
I think you just lost some molar on the end, so it feels like we should.
I'll call the meeting to order. We're running about 15 minutes late, so we'll try and pick that up on the tail end. Our meeting today. Well, first of all, I would like a motion to approve the agenda.
So move.
And the minutes included. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second to approve the agenda and the minutes. Any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion carries. Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Stein and Commissioner Rothman, for just an excellent presentation on climate change. It was just excellent. You moved it along very nicely. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to also compliment you on the way you handled the names. It was just right there. You had them nailed. So very good. Excellent. Again, our agenda is relatively short today. Our job really is to determine whether the Michelle and Tracy Erickson 19.11 acre mine site is a phased action to the Minnesota Sands multi-site EIS project. You have in your packet materials, several attachments, attachments number to 12. I'm hopeful that you've had a chance to peruse those attachments. I'm also I want to just mention that if you have, for those of you that are here for the public comment portion of it, if you have new information that you think the board would be interested in or could use as we move forward with this discussion, please keep that in mind as you come to the table. Again, we have several attachments, including the resolution and finding of fact and conclusion in order for the Erickson site and on through attachment number 12. So with that, I will ask Executive Director Seifert to have for any comments if he has, and if not, we'll move directly into the discussion.
Sure. Since time is of the essence, I'm going to quickly go through just a couple announcements. A number of questions were raised about accessibility of the presentations from the last from the subcommittee meeting. These will all be posted on our website, so stay tuned and you can get those. A couple things. The rulemaking advisory panel met again yesterday. It is our intent to have a proposal before the board for your consideration and discussion in September. In terms of your own planning, we're looking at traveling off-site for our August meeting, as we'll have our first climate report done then. So we will follow up with details, but just if you can make a mental scheduling note, and we'll be in touch ASAP with some details so you can plan accordingly if you're able to join us. And then just two brief staffing updates before moving on to the agenda before us. We're really excited to welcome Heather Ahrens to our team here on a part-time basis to be our lead on silica sand issues. She starts today. She'll be continuing her work for the DNR, too, on a part-time basis. I'm going to read her bio real quickly here. Heather is a state program director of industrial minerals for the Department of Natural Resources and has worked as a geologist for 16 years. She earned a degree in geological sciences, specializing in glacial geology and geomorphology from the University of Minnesota Morris. She's currently completing an MS in geological sciences from the University of Minnesota Duluth. Over the past 2 years, Heather has been working on silica sand-related projects. Currently, she's a coordinator for DNR's rulemaking effort for the reclamation of silica sand mines. She'll be still involved in that project, but she'll be leading our silica sand work as well. So feel free to deluge her email inbox as of today.
Mr. Welcome. Chairman, for the record, this is a temporary.
Sure.
We want her back, and Mr. Chairman, I also, if I could take just a moment to digress, another one of our great workers here, Melissa, is leaving, and we're going to miss her presence here and the work, great work she's done.
Thank you. Any other praises? Thank you. Will, anything else?
That's it.
Again, then I think we'll just move directly into the discussion regarding the Minnesota Sands multi-site EIS. At this time, does the board, members of the board, have any questions regarding the information that you found within your packet, the 12 attachments? Oh, yes, that's right.
Mr. Chair?
Of course, if we're going to get there regarding the packet. Yes.
I believe we...
Mr. Stein.
I was the one who made the motion at the last meeting to put the matter on the table. I believe it's... In order for us to reevaluate that, I should take the matter up and bring the matter up before the board. So I'd like to take the matter... I'd move to take this issue off the table.
Motion to remove from the table.
Second.
Is there a second? There is a second. I believe that we're able to discuss it. Is there further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. The motion carries. Now, Commissioner Stein.
So, Mr. Chair, the last meeting, my reservations about taking action on this question were in part because it was unclear to me what the county and the owners of Minnesota Sands and the property owners' intentions were. And there was a significant amount of testimony from members of the public and from representative of the county, representative of the company and the property owners that didn't quite seem sufficiently clear to me to bring the matter up for a vote for the board. I would note that, you know, in the intervening period of time, there's been a lot of communication back and forth. Planning Commission of the county has met and heard this matter, and there's even been some level of court intervention that is documented in attachment 12. Seeing all this, it's more clear to me now what the intention of the county, what the intention of the company and the property owners are, so I'm comfortable making a decision today. I think that there are still some questions that we should discuss as a board. My first question would be for Commissioner Landwehr. I noted in attachments 10 and 11 there's an exchange back and forth between the DNR and the county regarding the applicability of the trout stream setback permit for the Erickson property. And Commissioner, I'm just curious what your characterization of that exchange might be for the discussion here before the board.
Commissioner Landwehr.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Stein, the letter that is on attachment 10 from Julie Ekman really sort of expands on some of the issues I raised at the last meeting. That is, based on the information that we had at the time, there was not a conditional use permit in place, and that by virtue of that, if the Erickson's were going to proceed to mine, they would need a new conditional use permit, and that would trigger the requirement for a trout stream setback permit from the Department of Natural Resources, which was some of the new legislation of a year ago. And so there was discussion between our staff and Mr. Scanlon from the Houston County Zoning Administration about whether or not the permit was still valid. And I think in the interim, while we were transacting back and forth, the court actually acted and ruled on that question. Now, I understand that that can still be appealed, but the writ of mandamus essentially says that there is not a standing conditional use permit. So the point I was going to get to at the last one, it's my belief that by virtue of that, if a new permit is issued by the county, it is a new permit, and it will require that the Erickson's file for a trout stream setback.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Second question,
yeah,
Mr. Chair, just perhaps Ms. Hedman, I don't know if you have had a chance to review this, the court's decision on the writ of mandamus, but just to ask about the applicability of environmental review requirements. Does the county, by virtue of this, I was looking at the court's conclusion in the writ that speaks to the applicability of any environmental review, and I wasn't clear if there is a clear, if the court took a position about any mandatory categories or applicability of environmental review in this, in their decision. But if you could help me out with that, I'd appreciate it.
I'm happy to review it in detail, but I'd like to do that before responding, if that's okay.
Sure.
Other questions or comments? At this time, I'd like to ask Marilyn and Joanna if you'd like to come up and make comments. Welcome to the committee or to the board.
Chairperson Fredrickson, Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen of the board, thank you for this opportunity to address the Environmental Quality Board. My name is Marilyn Frown-Crown-Beyer, a lifelong resident of Houston County whose family first settled there in 1866. Seven subsequent generations of my family have chosen to call Houston County home. We, along with all Land Stewardship Project members, are greatly concerned about the Minnesota Sands LLC Environmental Impact Statement issue to be taken up at your meeting today. An important development has occurred since you last met. Despite the fact the Erickson Silica mine was still subject to environmental review, it appeared the county was going to move forward and permit it. Citizens felt forced to take court action to compel the county to follow the law. And on June 2nd, Judge Birnbaum signed a writ of mandamus declaring, number one, the CUP issued on January 8, 2008, has expired. Two, there is no existing CUP at this time for the site. Three, any application for a permit renewal must be rejected and returned. Four, any new application must be treated as an application for a new permit and be subject to current state law. Five, any new application is subject to the moratorium in effect on until March 2015. In light of this writ of mandamus, which is at the end of your packet in Attachment 12, there is no urgency for this matter to be decided upon by the EQB. Under the writ, Houston County may not approve a permit for the Erickson mine until the county moratorium expires in March 2015, and any new permit is subject to current state law, which would require obtaining the DNR silica sand mining trout stream setback permit with its one-year period of pre-application monitoring. This removes any need for the EQB to make a special decision outside of the normal environmental review scoping process on whether the Erickson silica sand mine is to be included in the Minnesota Sands LLC EIS. As Commissioner Stein pointed out at your last meeting, once the scoping process is complete, we will know what is included in the EIS, and therefore it will be clear what is out. Based upon the information Mr. Frick submitted, it appears the scoping may begin soon. However, if the board should decide to remove the Erickson silica sand mine from the EIS today, we believe such an order also needs to clarify the status of the environmental review at the site. The Erickson silica sand mine must complete a previously ordered environmental assessment worksheet before any permitting can begin. As you will remember, an EAW was ordered on the site by Houston County on August 7th, 2012, as a result of a citizen petition. Later, Houston County requested the EQB become the RGU on this project. and it be incorporated into the Minnesota Sands LLC EIS. If it is taken out of the EIS, the RGU for the EAW should be reassigned to the most appropriate agency. Since the project will require a DNR silica sand mining trout stream setback permit, we believe the more appropriate RGU would now be the DNR. To accomplish this, we would suggest the findings of fact, conclusion, and order be amended as follows. To findings of fact, add 1. The Erickson 19.11-acre mine will mine silica sand and is within a 1 mile of a designated trout stream. 2. In 2013, the Minnesota legislature passed legislation requiring new silica sand mines within a mile of a designated trout stream to obtain a silica sand mining trout stream setback permit from the DNR. 3. A previously issued conditional use permit for the Erickson Quarry has expired, and the site currently has no permit to mine. So future mining is subject to the 2013 law. This has been affirmed by the courts. To conclusions, add. 4. The Erickson 19.11-acre mine is required to obtain a DNR silica sand mining trout stream setback permit before any mining may take place. 5. The Erickson 19.11-acre mine is still subject to the previously ordered EAW, and the RGU is reassigned to the DNR. To order, add. The EQB orders the EAW completed on the Erickson 19.11-acre mine site, and the RGU is reassigned to the DNR. The decision the Environmental Quality Board makes here regarding the Erickson mine and the Minnesota Sands LLC environmental impact statement has far-reaching repercussions for the health of the land and the health of the well-being of the people of southeastern Minnesota, as well as the integrity of the environmental review process. The importance of this decision cannot be overemphasized for the people of southeastern Minnesota. Thank you again for this opportunity to address the Environmental Quality Board and for your service to the state of Minnesota and the future well-being of her next 7 generations. Good day.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Ms. Ruprecht?
Good afternoon. I'm Johanna Ruprecht. I'm an organizer with Land Stewardship Project in our Southeast Minnesota office. I live in Winona, Minnesota. I'd like to add just a few comments. First of all, I wanted to mention that Kelly Stanage of Houston County, who many of you have met and have seen up here before, was intending to come up and speak to you also today. She had some problems due to the storms that we've had recently. She wasn't able to make it. So it's not always easy for folks from Southeast Minnesota to make it up to St. Paul for this sort of thing. So I wanted to comment briefly on an issue that I believe she brought up to you at the last meeting. I want to call your attention back again to the dissolution of contract document that was submitted dissolving the contract between Minnesota Sands and the Ericksons. And I believe there are a lot of outstanding questions as to whether that document has been fully executed or whether it even can be fully executed in light of the current situation. That document purporting to be the dissolution of contract includes in point 5, Tracy Erickson shall complete all matters necessary to obtain his existing permit from Houston County. And that has not happened yet, and that may not be something that can ever happen because, as we've discussed under the writ of mandamus, there is no existing permit, and that was signed by the judge, and that is currently in place, so as Commissioner Landwehr has mentioned as well. So I just want you to keep that in mind when you're considering the decision about the relationship between Erickson and Minnesota Sands and whether that has been legally severed. Thank you for your time. Any questions?
Questions for either Ms. Beyer or Ms. Ruprecht? If not, thank you very much for taking the time to be here. Mr. Erickson, do you have your hand up back there? Pardon me? Oh, okay. Welcome to the board, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. Jay Squires with Rupp Anderson Squires, Waldsberger. I've been working with the county over the last number of years on land use matters, including this matter.
Can you pull the mic in front of you, please?
It's important to clarify the writ that was included in your packet because it's been referred to as the court order, and the court has made these determinations. That's not the case. Under the writ of mandamus statute, Chapter 586 is a statute. There's a two-step process, and if you look at the last page of the writ, it indicates that the county is to appear at a hearing and show cause as to why a further writ should not be issued. So in that respect, it's in the nature of an order to show cause. This writ is drafted by the applicant, so this was drafted by the landowners. It's presented to the judge signs the order, and then the next thing for the county to do is to answer the allegations in that writ. The county answered the writ, and under that statute, the answer is sufficient, a sufficient denial that then the matter is processed as any other civil action. So the court has not made any determinations on the merits of any of these issues, on whether the permit still exists, on how the county's moratorium applies to this particular issue. In fact, there's a hearing on Monday before the judge, Birnbaum, that signed the order where the parties will present their case, and one of the options that's being asked of the judge is to dismiss the case in its entirety. So just to be clear, the landowners have offered that to you and suggested the judge has made all these determinations. That's not the case. Those are yet to come. The second point, brief point I wanted to make is that there have been a lot of issues in this case. This case has been layered upon layered, and it's very complex, and there are many local issues, and there's the issue before this board today on the issue of the EIS. But those issues that are involved in the mandamus proceeding, whether the landowner's entitled to renewal of the permit based on all the facts that occurred and how and when they occurred, how the county's moratorium applied, those are certainly local issues that the county has to grapple with and work out with. The property owners and Mr. Erickson, unfortunately, in a judicial process. But those, excuse me, those really aren't the issues for this board. The issue at the EQB level is the issue as to whether the Erickson property is a related or a phased action under EQB rules based on the information available. That's your piece in this puzzle. The other issues, the concerns the property owner has, and the property owners have, and certainly they have a right to have those concerns should be worked through and addressed, and there are different processes that go on. But those concerns are not really relevant to the issue before you, and that's looking at the EQB rules, the definition of phased and related action with the information that's been provided to you. Is it the case that the Erickson property, in light of that information, is a related or phased action of the Minnesota Sands projects that exist in other areas? So those are the only comments that I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about the other things that have gone on in this case over the last number of years.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Squires, for presenting. My understanding is your attorney representing the county board. Is that your?
That's correct.
You're under contract through the insurance trust. That's the relationship that exists?
No, not on these issues. When there was litigation that was covered by the county's insurance trust, they appointed me and their self-insurance pool, but that would have been the case, for example, with the underlying Minnesota Sands lawsuit from a number of years ago. But with respect to this particular issue, no, the county contracts with me directly to assist it.
Thank you. And so your presentation today is a county perspective. Would it be fair for me to characterize that as you're here representing the county board?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Further questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
Squires. And also thank you again for reminding us. And if you read the resolution, that is exactly what the board is being asked to do. And it is also fairly clear in the finding of fact that our responsibility really goes directly to the issue that you outlined very well, and that is whether or not it is a phased and connected. At this point, is there further comment or discussion? Again, you have finding of fact in your packet. And we also have a resolution. The resolution the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board regarding the removal of a site from the proposed Minnesota Sands LLC multi-site environmental impact statement ordered on March 20th of 2013. The resolution further states, be it resolved that the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board approves and adopts the findings of fact, conclusion, and order identifying the 19.11-acre Erickson proposed project as an action which is not phased and effectively removing it from the mines included in the Minnesota Sands LLC environmental impact statement.
Mr. Chair, at some point I'd like to offer an amendment to the findings of fact and conclusions of law in order. If it's in order now, we're
well, I think we should get the resolution in front of us at this point in time. So a motion would be in order.
I will move the resolution as drafted.
There is a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
There is a second. Now, on the amendment.
So, Mr. Chair, on findings of fact number 8, says according to the terms of the dissolution of contract, I would add the three words, and testimony received, right before the comma.
Is there a second to the amendment?
No second.
There is. Now, further discussion on the amendment.
Let me just speak to it. I think that we had, in fact, even today and at the original hearing, a lot of testimony that explained the dissolution, and I think it was helpful to have that and should be referenced in our order here.
So on the motion as amended, Brian?
I was just curious, given the complexity of the documentation of this package, I wonder if we're going to add that comment and testimony received, if it should be specific to the EQB testimony provided at last month's meeting. It appears, I mean, it could be mistaken which testimony we're looking at when you look at the number of documents that we have here.
You know, Mr. Chair, I mean, the intention here was to talk about just the testimony, not necessarily the documentation. So,
correct. I'm just wondering what testimony received. Was it testimony received in the writ hearing, or was it testimony received? Oh, you're saying all testimony.
It was I intended to mean at the board meeting on this matter.
Right. And that's what I assumed you meant, but I don't know that somebody else could read this document and assume that that's what you meant.
And testimony received by the EQB.
Yeah.
On May 18th, if you just want to add.
Yeah, I'm fine. Either way, if you want to specify it that way.
Friendly amendment to the amendment on May 18th?
Sure.
All right. Do you want to read the amendment as proposed?
And testimony received at the May 18th, 2014 EQB meeting.
Okay. Now, have we?
Any more discussion on the amendment? Yes.
Okay. Any more discussion on this particular amendment? If not, what I'd like to do is just incorporate it into the motion, and then we'll vote on the motion.
The previous EQB meeting was May 21st, actually.
Was it May 21?
Thank you.
I was reading. I was reading from the notes.
Further discussion on the amendment to the motion, John.
Chair, are we discussing the amendment or the motion in general? I'm sorry.
At this point in time, we're discussing the amendment.
Thank you.
All right. On the let's then move. I'm getting a little out of sync here. Unfortunately, usually we vote an amendment, but. I think we can incorporate the amendment as a friendly amendment and then move directly to the motion. So on the motion.
To amend, so moved, and then I think you vote.
You want us to vote on the amendment then? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Now on the motion as amended.
On the findings.
I'm on sorry. The findings. Well, it's the resolution, which includes the findings. As amended.
Sure.
We're going to get this figured out here.
Thank you. I think Mr. Squires raised one important point that I just want to amplify, which is the citizens and property owners in the county have not fully addressed local concerns in this matter, and that there are significant local concerns yet to be addressed. And I'm going to vote in favor of this motion. I think that it's been clear how the county intends to operate, and Mr. Frick from the his corporate perspective is declared his interest very clearly. I do, however, believe that there are still significant differences that need resolution that the county needs to attend to, and I'm hopeful that Mr. Scanlon, when he hears about this, or I see him there, you are, that will generate meaningful discussion at the county office about how to address concerns that the residents have.
Thank you. Other comments?
Mr. Chairman, question as much as anything. I think it accurately pointed out we've got a pretty narrow question before us, whether or not these are phased actions or not, and the preponderance of evidence I've seen suggests these are not connected or phased actions. What if subsequently something turns up that shows these are phased actions, either during the preparation of the EIS or after the preparation of the EIS? Is there some recourse at that point in time? And maybe this is a question for Mr. Seufert or somebody who's got, or Leah, somebody who's got some expertise with it. Because it would seem as easy as it is to dissolve, it's just as easy to.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, Mr. Landwehr, my name is Kate France, and I am EQB staff, lead for the environmental review. And the question I understand is, if the scope of the environmental review in the EIS were to change, how would that be handled? And that would be reviewed in the amendments to the scoping decision. That's one point that we could look to. It's in Chapter 4410 under 2100, the scoping process for the EIS. Basically, what it describes is once the scope is determined, if there's a change, then the RGU, being the EQB in this case for Minnesota Sands, can go back to adequately rescope the EIS so that the project is accurately captured.
Mr. Chair, it will take some time to do the EIS. We go through the EIS process, and it's still assumed that during that period of time, the scope is a number of projects. It doesn't include the Erickson mine. Subsequent to the completion of the EIS, it's found out that there is a connection. What's the recourse at that point in time? Because then the project is substantially changed from that which was scoped and subsequent EIS developed.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, one of the clauses that is included in the rule offers the RGU the opportunity for if there is a change in the project between when the environmental review is completed and all governmental actions have been completed, but not all construction has been done, there is an opportunity to go back to review the project. Now, that typically occurs at an EAW level, but there will be opportunities for discretionary review should you choose to follow that.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just thinking through this while we're sitting here, so I apologize for the dragging on here. But so, you know, how would that impact the actual operation? So the EIS, a permit can be issued to Minnesota Sands subsequent to the development of an EIS. If an operation was not originally scoped in the EIS, but it is later determined that that operation has been ongoing with a business relationship that wasn't identified it's not an, there's no recourse for the EQB in terms of the operation of the mine, correct? It becomes an local unit of government issue at that point in time, or?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, yeah. And Mr. Commissioner, if there is no pending governmental action, if there were no new CUP or no interim use permit, then there can be no environmental review applied. And so that might be where you have some questions here is environmental review is ultimately a planning process. So if there is no pending governmental decision, you're right, there would be some challenges to include that. But if there are other projects that are planned or projects that plan to expand associated with Minnesota Sands, that could be incorporated into the scope of the EIS.
Yeah, Ms. Hedman can also lend some knowledge.
I don't disagree with what EQB staff has said. In addition, under 4410.3000 supplementing an EIS, should there be a substantial change have been made in the proposed project that affects the potential significant adverse environmental effects of the project? That's one of the examples. But what you're almost referring to sounds as though, if you have questions of the project proposer here today with regard to the Minnesota Sands EIS, I think they're present, and you also, within the friendly amendment, have now added the testimony that EQB received last board meeting in May of 2014. So they did make several statements on the record to this board. Mm-hmm. So if they were to go against those statements and actually have a contractual relationship which they've expressed to this board is not happening, it would be somewhat of a fraud upon this board. So I think that a supplemental EIS could be ordered, and the project proposer would have to pay the additional costs for that and the costs of the original EIS. It's going to be more money because you have to redo everything you already did. So they pay for that in addition to going through time delays, etc. So there is, it would be a tantamount to fraud, I think, at this point with the things that have been made on the record.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, members, I think the reason that I'm kind of struggling with is I think in many cases the RGU is the same as the permitting authority, and that's not the case here. We're the RGU for the EIS, but we're not the RGU for the permitting. So if it rests in one entity and the RGU finds out that they have been misled, they have the direct permitting authority under which they can, you know, do a cease and desist, for instance, or something like that. I don't know if we have that authority as RGU for the EIS, but not the RGU for the subsequent permit, CUP.
Please.
So 4410.3000 is supplementing an EIS, and it says the RGU shall prepare a supplement to an EIS. So as the RGU for the Minnesota Sands EIS, EQB would have such authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So on that particular point, with regard to the CUP or something else, that would be maybe in the local hands of the local county authorities, I think.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess, sorry to belabor this, but presuming we got to that point, do we have the ability to do a stop order on a project? I mean, we don't have any permitting authority on the project, so we would engage in a supplemental EIS, but that doesn't necessarily have any impact on a particular project.
Should I respond?
Sure.
Okay. I think you're asking me to do an unresearched legal question, so I don't know that I can confidently give you answers. There are legal mechanisms to pursue. I can think of, similar to a stop work order, but like a temporary injunction, et cetera. But I don't know in terms of the applicability. I don't know that it's been done. I don't whether it could be done. I hate to expound on that today.
Okay.
Sorry, is that a bad answer? I actually want to research it.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Commissioner.
Yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me. I just wanted to add one point to that. Thank you for the addition, Ms. Hedman. That if there is the supplement for the EIS, then 4410.3100, the prohibition on final governmental actions, would apply. So that the Minnesota rules does carry the weight of law. So, again, we would have to consult with your Attorney General staff, but that prohibition on governmental actions would apply in that case for a supplemental EIS.
Mm-hmm. Further questions or comments on the motion as amended? If not, all those, I think probably do we need a roll call on this? I'll ask Will to call the roll. On the motion as amended.
Okay, on the motion to adopt the resolution and findings as amended, Chair Fredrickson?
Yes.
Commissioner Clark Sieben?
Yes.
Ms. Idy Tollison?
Abstain.
Commissioner Ellinger?
Yes.
Ms. Gehring?
Yes.
Commissioner Lamware?
Yes.
Commissioner Napstad?
Yes.
Commissioner Rothman?
Yes.
Mr. Saxog?
Yes.
Commissioner Linkstein?
Yes.
Mr. Erickson, Mr. Tomlinson?
Yes.
Prevail. Ten.
There being 10 ayes and 1 abstaining, the motion prevails. Is Mr. Crick here? Can you tell me, in your letter of May 29th, Mr. Frick, you reference Roger Dabbelstein in Fillmore County, and then in Winona County, you reference Mr. Roger Dabbelstein. Are they one and the same, or?
Yeah, just they have property in Winona and Fillmore.
But you spell them Dobbelstein.
That's my fault.
Okay, so it's the same person.
The same person.
All right.
Same
okay.
As Harry Kessler, just that these two landowners have property in Winona and Fillmore counties.
I see.
You got to do it on all of them, so.
You might want to redo that and resubmit, maybe.
I will.
Will you? Okay. Yep. Thank you.
And just one other question. Is Houston County out of the EIS then?
I don't think that we addressed it from a county perspective. We addressed it from an individual perspective, Mr. Erickson's mind.
Well, that
19.11 acre plot.
Can you make a ruling on that?
That we take the entire county out? I would doubt that that would be.
Not at this point. If the county brings forward a request at a later date, we can consider.
Please.
Sure. The issue is not before us today, Mr. Frick. If the county has an additional request they want to bring forward to the board for consideration, there's a pathway to resolving those issues.
The reason I give you everything is that I'm not doing it on Houston County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you said something to when hell freezes over or something like that. I thought so, yeah. All right. I think we got it.
I already talked to Denise, and I'll return and submit that list to Will, and I'll have the spelling right.
Yeah, okay, good. Further business that should come before the board? Hearing none.
Move to adjourn.
A motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Second.
There is. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you.